now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF.
That's 313-298-9743.
Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Julene Jordan, hi.
Hi, Peter.
Well, we missed the big demonstration in Washington, D.C. yesterday,
yeah,
didn't we?
Yeah, I hate missing those things.
Both of us, because we love a parade, particularly when it's all the lefties and the progressives and the liberals and the, all those folks.
Socialists, crazy socialists.
Yeah, and saying something, you know, putting forth some proposals to deal with the problem.
Rather than just bitching about it.
Yeah, or saying, what was that other one? Restoring our honor. No one knew what the hell that meant.
Remember, we still don't.
After that one in August, that with the real inflated figures of how many people attended, it was called Restoring Our Nation's Honor or something. Restoring Our Honor, I think it was. And the head whack job that called it said that the whole thing was bring the nation back to God. To which we said we would invite anyone in our listening audience to tell us, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that mean programmatically? How does that stop foreclosures? How does it get you or your neighbor a job? How does that bail out our states or our cities? I don't understand it. I mean, we could pray. You know, they say pray for peace.
Yeah. Oh,
well, good.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Detroit Area Peace with Justice Network sent 3 buses to Washington. That's from Sigrid.
Thank you, Sigrid.
Thank you.
Peace out.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Peace on.
You listen to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Our phone number, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And we're interested if people went to that march. Anybody that wants to give us a call, let us know what it was all about. I never saw any figures on it, but I do have some news. I have some news reports. They're interesting because of what they say and don't say. Because usually, right, so these righties, you know, they can fart in public and, you know, they put them on the front page of every publication, right?
Yeah.
And yet when anyone on the left, no matter what is done, how many people show up, and saying the big example was 20,000, well, but you know, actually, I've admitted that's an exaggeration. 15,000 people, maybe 20, but okay, 15,000 people in June here at the United States Social Forum. Not even a blip on the national media. 600-700 teabaggers get together in Nashville, and they're outnumbered by the media. What is so attractive about them that is not very interesting to the media about? Well, maybe because we're not nuts and we don't say crazy things.
Yeah,
and we don't
people
have...
like the spectacle.
Yeah, maybe that's it. This is the age of the spectacle, the society of the spectacle, as one book is entitled.
Mm.
But anyway, here, this is from Yahoo News, but it came through... I guess it is just... Now, this is very interesting. Progressives, unions, civil rights groups, and their supporters from around the country converged in Washington Saturday for the One Nation Working Together March, designed to inspire and re-energize progressives 1 month out from Election Day. Under the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial, speakers including the head of the AFL-CIO, the Reverend Al Sharpton, Van Jones, and others urged progressives to get involved in this year's election in order to support jobs, immigration, public schools, unions, and other issues of importance to their community. Let's see. But here, the AP and USA Today put crowd estimates for Saturday's events in the thousands.
Yeah, sounds about
right. What does that sound like? It sounds like about 3,000 something like that. Now, it's interesting. The Teabagger Rally in August, they claimed, I mean, extravagant figures, and I don't care. I mean, they can say they had 1 million or 10 million. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. Maybe they only had 80,000 like that aerial shot showed.
Yeah.
I don't think those things are too relevant. I mean, what we always used to say, and maybe we still say it, is that really what matters is the day after. I mean, in Spanish and French, the word for demonstration really is manifestación. Mm-hmm. That is a manifestation of the politics that you're supporting, that you're trying to bring about in the community or by voting or whatever manner, you know, that you're, whatever tactic or strategy you're up to. But you could see, they actually showed, because remember that that nutbag running the teabagger rally was, did it on the anniversary of the Martin Luther King March.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King March had 250,000 people at it. And I saw some, well, keep this in mind what I'm saying, because it may be contradicted by what I say in a couple sentences from now. But you could see, you could see the 250,000 at the, around the reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial that then, you know, stretches back to the Washington Monument. And the Martin Luther King authentic one, the real American, if you will,
right.
In 1963, you could tell had considerably more people. Now, they said that AP and USA Today put crowd estimates for Saturday's event in the thousands. I submit to you, and I say the prosecution exhibit number A.
Wow.
I mean, that's big.
That's huge.
Okay, pass it back, please.
Okay, here you go.
All right. 'Cause but they call it in the thousands. Some participants characterized Saturday's march as a response to the guy's, I don't even like to say his name, teabagger rally in the National Mall, and his rally held in August dwarfed Saturday's event in terms of size. I mean, if you look empirically, it looks identical for what that's worth. But what I'm interested in here, I'm not interested in numbers games, and you know, because you have the most people doesn't mean that you're correct or that you have the best ideas.
True.
Or what have you. Can you think Nuremberg rallies, you know,
mm-hmm.
Hitler and those
right.
guys? Yeah, okay. But here's another one. This is from, I can't even see what the, Huffington Post. Tens of thousands of progressives rallied the Lincoln Memorial for Jobs, Justice, and Education. And they start off, tens of thousands of civil rights, labor, and other progressive activists gathered on the National Mall today for One Nation Working Together rally. Organizers insisted that One Nation was not a response to the, to the teabagger rally. Restoring Honor, that was the name. Again, if anybody can tell me what in the hell that means. Okay. So there actually was a little bit more prior publicity than I've ever seen for a march.
Yeah. It was pretty big.
As opposed to, like, all the media went out full stop to advertise this far right wing rally that happened in August.
Yeah.
Maybe we can say the guy's name. Jesus. I mean, I hate to even let it pass my lips. It's doing him such a service. The Glenn Beck rally.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I turned on ABC News on Saturday night, and they showed the marchers, and then they had speech clips from Al Sharpton, Reverend Al Sharpton, and Reverend Jesse Jackson, and they interviewed a couple of people. Now, please, no one make any assessment or assumption till I finish this thought. You would have thought from the ABC coverage that it was a African-American civil rights march, which, as we say about other things, there's nothing wrong with that at all.
Right.
But that's not what it was all about. In fact, the whole idea that this thing that it was One Nation working together was that it was about diversity. It was about all of us, that it reflected the character and the color and the diversity that is America, and not these people that are so far out in dreamland that think it's the 1950s still. I mean, most of those, that was a long time ago. That was a half century ago. But, both you and I, having worked in media, Jalene, and knowing that what you choose and how you position things, even though it appears objective,
is effective.
and characterize it. Now, there's tons of white people that hate Reverend Al Sharpton and hate Jesse Jackson. Now, the people, and I certainly think it's legitimate to show Reverend Jesse Jackson. Sharpton's another thing. I mean, he always say a spokesman for the black community. Well, who the hell elected him?
Yeah, he elected himself.
No, he didn't even. He says decent things, and he's made some bad mistakes in his past.
But he's done a lot of good. So it's Jesse Jackson.
But essentially, it's the media. He totally. I mean, he's one of those people that's famous for being famous.
Yeah.
Although he's been an activist and organized people and all. I don't want to take it all away from Reverend Al. Remember, you weren't there at the Bush. Or were you? Were we at the Bush counter inaugural in 2000? Were you there with me?
Yeah, I was there. We were there.
And Reverend Al, he gave a barn burner of a speech. So I'm not putting the guy down. Every person that they interviewed, and again, let me explain this all out, that ABC News interviewed in the crowd was African-American. And it could be just an accent, but you know what? They send lots of people out there, and someone chose all this to give it a narrow character. And it's not like it's a bad character. It's not like those people don't have legitimacy as a community, that they were a major part of it, the NAACP, the Urban League, Jesse Jackson's group, and what have you. And I'm not trying to take anything away from anybody, but it looked like something that a right-wing site would do, figuring they could get white antipathy towards it, or say, oh, that's a march of colored people, or something like that. Or am I reading this wrong? I mean, it could have been maybe the people that were doing it, younger people, that really were colorblind and said, hey, that's a good clip from Reverend Al. That's a good clip from Jesse Jackson. But where was, I can't think of his first name, Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, who represents an enormous constituency of millions. Where was Bob King's statement, who represents hundreds of thousands of UAW
workers?
Right,
true.
So, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's not fair. Maybe I'm putting some jacket on them they don't deserve. Well, anybody listening that actually went there, we missed it. Jalene and I did. But I'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF. You'd like to email us, by the way. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. And actually, you could have followed it. I guess it was all on, what was it, Free Speech TV or something like that.
Some people
I talked to saw it.
Unfortunately,
though, it was not a march, because you know, I love a parade, and it was just a rally.
I love a protest.
Yeah, well, it was. But the thing was that it really was, from everything I saw about it and the reports that I read about it, were that it was positive in the sense that was putting forth a vision of change, something that has been going on way too slowly. And it's eroded the faith and confidence of people in the Obama administration. Too many things like the one that he replaced, and too many things that just haven't come about. I mean, there's been hundreds and hundreds of changes that really aren't very evident. That that Bush gave away the store to the rich guys 100%. I mean, it's moved away considerably from that. Not enough, that's for sure. All right. Let me urge any of you that were there to give us a call at 313-298-WRIF. But let's talk about the other story that's gotten national publicity because of this very, very strange homophobic assistant attorney general.
Here in Michigan.
Here in Michigan, yeah. Andrew Chervelle. Did you happen to see the clip on Carlson Tucker's show?
No.
Ooh.
What?
Scary guy.
Really?
Yeah, well, here's what happened. Andrew Chervelle is a Michigan assistant attorney general, and he's now been banned from the University of Michigan campus, and what he's been doing, he's been harassing this campus student leader, head of
the student body president.
Student body president, who happens to be gay. And this guy is a homophobic maniac.
He really is.
Yeah, who has a website called, now what's the young man's name? Chris Armstrong. Chris Armstrong Watch. And he was trailing the guy, taking films of his house at 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah, 1:30 in the morning. What was his whole purpose? And why was he after this guy? He's clearly gay himself. I mean, we've established that whole train.
Well, yeah, and again, not that there's anything wrong with that, unless you're repressing it.
Right. Well, you're repressing yourself and repressing others at the same time.
Yeah. Now, he accuses Chris Armstrong, the student. And imagine this. This is this grown man, this lawyer, who was actually head of the election committee for Attorney General Cox, where Chervelle. Wow, I just thought, never mind. I don't want to go there.
I saw where you were going.
Yeah. On this, Chris Armstrong, who's this young man, 21, it's an adult man and all that, but this grown-up Michigan Assistant Attorney General is harassing this guy. And in fact, now that...
He's been suspended, right?
Well, he has been suspended. There's going to be a disciplinary hearing for him. Now, this is interesting. The American Civil Liberties Union has defended the right of the harasser, the Assistant Attorney General, Ander Chervel, to carry out at least his spoken word. I don't know if they would, there's certain things that harassing and stalking behavior. Course,
yeah, that's a felony.
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of what Assistant Attorney General Chervel was saying on his blog, the ACLU was defending his right to, in fact, say that and to publish that. And it's pretty bad if your employer can come after you for your off-hours deal. But here's the thing. I mean, there's certain jobs which depend on public confidence. And would anyone who was gay or not gay have the confidence in the Michigan Assistant Attorney General, Andrew Chervel, to equally and fairly enforce the laws of the state of Michigan against discrimination based on gender or sexual preference?
No.
Of this guy is stalking this young man.
Who just wants to lead.
Yeah.
At the University of Michigan.
Well, it's absolutely incredible the kind of... support that he's gotten. The whole university has turned out to support him. There is now a trespass order against him by the University of Michigan police.
Good.
And I was looking on here, I was trying to find the university president, Mary Sue Coleman, called the assistant attorney general's behavior reprehensible. She said, as a community, we must not and will not accept displays of intolerance. Chervel is worried that Chris Armstrong is trying to carry out a radical homosexual agenda.
I mean, think about Ann Arbor. It's such a diverse town and it's such a diverse campus. This guy was just bound to lose.
Yeah. And, of course, what the other really tragic event regarding sexual preference was that young man at Rutgers who committed suicide after a prank was played on him, where two other Rutgers students, an 18-year-old Darun Ravi and 18-year-old Molly Wei, had set up a camera.
They streamed it online.
And they streamed him kissing a man, or maybe even sexual activity. It was sexual activity? Okay.
Yeah.
And then this young man, Tyler Clemente, committed suicide. He was
absolutely horrible. He jumped off the bridge.
The George Washington Bridge. Yeah. Into the Hudson River. And he was an accomplished violinist. And yesterday he was supposed to play in the Rutgers Symphony. And they dedicated the symphony the whole night to him, and they had an empty chair where he would have sat.
Oh, this one they both made me sick, but when is this hatred and bigotry going to end?
Well, not with the American Family Association, which is this far right-wing Christian group, which is trying to carry out a boycott of the Home Depot. And they're upset because the Home Depot has, like, for instance, within it, they have a pride, a Home Depot pride for gay employees. They've supported marches, like gay pride parades. Mm-hmm. And that's probably twofold. I mean, always, I'm never completely sold that this is all done out of altruism by any corporation whenever they support anything. Part of it is they want to
look PC.
Yeah, they want to look PC. They want to figure out. We'll get these people in.
Yeah,
store.
True.
So the American Family Association is carrying out a call for a boycott against the Home Depot, which they have every right to do. But they ought to understand that this often leads to what happened to Tyler Clemente.
Yes.
That this Andrew Chervel ought to understand that as well. I mean, it's good that this Chris Armstrong, the president of the Michigan Student Assembly, is a strong young man and stood up to him, got a restraining order, a personal protection order against this whack job that we're paying with our tax dollars here in Michigan.
This is the kind of person, by the way, election coming up, right?
And here, this is what Tyler Clemente's family said, the young man that jumped off the bridge after he was publicly humiliated by him being shown to have sex with another man online. The family said, "We understand that our family's personal tragedy presents important legal issues for the country as well as for us. Regardless of legal outcomes, our hope is that our family's personal tragedy will serve as a call for compassion, for empathy, and for human dignity." You ever hear these words mentioned by the right wing, particularly compassion or empathy?
No.
You know, I think I mentioned this before, haven't I? In the movie Blade Runner, but also from
I've actually seen that one, Peter.
Do you remember what that was all about? How they could tell replicants that
through the eyes.
And what could they tell?
Oh, they showed emotion.
They had no capacity for empathy.
Yeah, they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Philip K. Dick, who wrote the novel from which it was taken, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, that's what he said characterized us as human beings, the capacity for empathy.
Yeah.
And when you cannot empathize with other people, and it's real easy to empathize with people just like you, but what it's hard is, how do you empathize with other people that sometimes may even make you a little uncomfortable given your experiences or your other belief? How can you extend your sense of humanity to them as much as you would to someone who's just like you and makes you feel 100% absolutely comfortable?
I just don't think it's that hard.
No, it's not.
But for some people, it's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. So the results of all bigotry is always, we think about discrimination, but so frequently it's harm. It's even death in the case of Tyler Clemente. And I would say that people like the Assistant Attorney General, Andrew Chervell, the American Family Association, they bear responsibility for these deaths.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. 313-298-WRIF. Let's take a call. I want to get Gary. Gary's listening in Maryland. He was at the rally yesterday in Washington, D.C. Gary, welcome to the show.
Hey, nice to speak with both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was funny when I was at the rally. I was thinking that I said, you know, I said the news media is going to make it this just a black and white thing in terms of the Glenn Beck rally being the white people. And this rally being the black people, but you know, being at the rally, I can say it was probably more of a good third of people were white, a third maybe were Hispanic, and maybe a third were African American.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, that sounds
there was a lot. There was definitely a lot of you know, not that I go around kind of white people, but it was definitely a lot of a good representation of, you know, different cultures, different people of America. I mean, it really was representative of America.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm just, you know, I'm not shocked that they would do something like that. I mean, the media is just, it's really sad what's happening with the media.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you, Gary, I haven't given this talk in a long time, but whenever I would give a talk on the media, I don't want to get an invitation. I was going to say, no one's given me one in a long time. But I would start off, you know, there could be 20 people in a room, 200 people in a room one time, I remember. And I said, how many people here think the media is doing their job? And no one raises their hand, of course. Right. And I say, am I the only person here who thinks the media is doing exactly what it's set up to do? That is to misinform, disinform, take issues, bring issues to the fore that have no real bearing on what's really important. So, yeah, I don't know. What do you think, though? Let me just bring people up to speed. I said early at the beginning of the show, and I'm just repeating this for the audience, Gary, that may be just joining us, that it looked on ABC News like they were purposely trying to portray it as an all-African-American event, which would be perfectly okay, except that's not what it was. And what Gary said and what I saw from the photographs, it was this diverse crowd representative of who we all really are. So what do you think? You think it was an accident, or do you think, could have just been somebody?
I would say one thing I did notice is probably a few more African-American speakers at the event in terms of what I saw just that was actually on the screen. I mean, you had the president of the NEA, white male, he was on, and I saw him speak, and a couple other people. There were a lot of African Americans in terms of speaking. You know, they had a couple of Indian speakers and, you know, Asian. But in general, I mean, I don't think someone would try to focus. I think you would try to diversify as a media and show different speakers. I don't think you would sit there and try to play, you know, just clips of blacks speaking.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, my hope would be that it was really somebody who really was post-racial, that was moved by the, you know, you had all these little clips and you
didn't even think about it.
And didn't even think about it. I mean, can we move finally to that? And that skin color or ethnic background will make us about as big a difference as the color of our eyes. You know,
which and one thing I was going to say just about the numbers, because I was actually at the Million Man March. And I've been to a number of marches there. I can't really estimate exactly what that crowd was because, you know, when you're on the ground, you're walking around.
Sure.
That's
but, I mean,
to
I
do.
Walked all the way from the back of the mountain, the monument up. It was a pretty good crowd. I think the one thing I did notice that the crowd kind of left a little earlier than some of the other marches that I've been to. Like, if you were there, like, to about 4 or 5, it kind of thinned out pretty quickly after that. I don't know why. But if you were there between 12 and 2, it was pretty packed. It was clearly, I can't estimate, but it was clearly more than a football game. Okay.
Well, that would be more than 100,000. But I'll tell you, Gary, I actually read somewhere that people began leaving towards the end. But 4 hours of speeches, like Jalene and I were saying earlier, when we've been to these marches, when we've been to Washington, they've always been marches. And those are really energizing. And I had a lot of reasons where I didn't go. One of them actually was because it wasn't a march.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Hey, Gary, how did you find out about our show all the way over in Maryland?
Oh, I've been listening for a while. I think I found you years ago, maybe on iTunes.
Okay.
Hey, all right.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, appreciate it.
And calling.
Yeah, and for calling, indeed. And we do have callers from all around the country. In fact, we're picking up one from Georgia in a minute. Let's go to Keith in Livonia. Keith, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Welcome.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Jalene.
Hi.
Hello.
A real pleasure to talk to you. Peter, I want to begin by thanking you yet again for your kind assistance in helping to promote the event that we're doing at the McComb Center for the Performing Arts this
coming
Friday night.
Yeah.
Rock and Roll Classics for Earthquake Relief, featuring the two hottest bands in Michigan, and no doubt in my mind, the Backbeats and Echoes of Pink Floyd.
Oh,
otherwise,
yes!
I would have been in Washington myself, but the show is in 5 days, and it's getting to crunch time.
We're big fans of the Backbeats and Echoes of Pink Floyd. Those are my boys. Those are my friends.
Listen,
they have lasers.
It's going to be an unbelievable show. I am expecting to hear from the Honorable John Conyers' office tomorrow as to whether he will speak, and he told me he would be honored to speak at the end of intermission about the situation in Haiti.
Oh, great.
So I'm waiting on that, and of course I couldn't talk about this without giving thanks to your good friend Doug Podell next door.
I was going to say, probably, you know...
Everyone on this frequency who's listening probably knows that name.
So Doug Podell is going to be the MC of the event.
That is correct.
Yeah, yeah.
That is correct. And to top it all off, I have just come from a friend and his little video production company who are producing a concert DVD of the Backbeats from the 40th anniversary of the release of Abbey Road, which you, my friend Peter, emceed last year at the Majestic Theater.
The Backbeats, by the way, we should say, is a Beatles tribute band.
Yes.
and does
and
all their
through,
songs.
They do some shows where they go through all the different different phases.
Well, listen, I have a video DVD in my possession, and we're going to be rolling this out in about 4 weeks. Of just an unbelievable collection of Beatles songs, masterfully edited, and I'm almost speechless.
Okay. Well, let me see. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Go down the left side, and there's a little Skyline of Detroit. Click on that. That will bring you to my calendar page. It'll give you all the details about the concert on Saturday. Saturday, is it? Right?
Friday night.
Friday night. I knew it was. Friday night. Yeah.
And one more little bit of magic on this end is that my website, www.betterworldhappenings.com, is now up and running.
Okay.
So thank you both for giving me this time, and it's going to be a great show, folks.
The other way around. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
All right. Keith from Livonia, thank you so much. And let's see. Let's we only have one commercial. So we got time. We can get Tim in from Georgia, but he's in Washington right now. Tim, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, welcome, Pete.
Yeah, thank you.
It was quite a rally, I will say that.
Yeah.
There was a great outshowing of many union supports, many anti-war supports. We had veterans from peace. It was just stunning.
Did you see the
talkers were incredible.
The what were? Oh, the talkers.
The speakers. Yeah, the speakers were incredible.
Yeah. Did you see?
I want to say thing, though. And I had a friend who's in the Teamsters.
Yeah.
There was very little Teamsters here at all. In fact, hardly any. And it's sad but true. When I called my friend back home in Akron, Ohio, well, where I'm originally from, he didn't even know what was going on. And they've had everything from they had the Teachers Association. They had, obviously, a huge outpouring of what you want to hear is the auto workers.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They had them. They had communication workers. They had it. Obviously, AFSCME, and on and on and on. But it's kind of sad the Teamsters are left behind on this one. I don't know what's going on with them.
Well, I have a suggestion after we end our call, but I don't know if this was the cause of it all. But we'll see. All right. Well, thanks for the report. How many you ever hear any number? How many people were there?
Well, I was talking to a guy who came up here from Virginia, a local guy, and he went and checked out the Glenn Beck Valley, and he was telling me, I never seen so many wheelchairs, scooters, and what do they call oxygen-generating machines.
Yeah.
In his whole life, and he said, this is a cross-section of America, and that wasn't.
Well, let's be kind to our elders. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for the report. What we're talking about is the big rally that was in Washington, D.C., the left.
Yesterday.
Yesterday. The left rallying. And I mean, I hope that they do more with it than just go and vote for the Democrats. I mean, mm-hmm. and that's a question we haven't really talked about. And I keep going back and forth with that. I mean, the Democrats have been disappointing. And so it's not that I don't think so many people are going to be changing their vote as much that a lot of people that were enthusiastic about Barack Obama in 2008 are just going to stay home.
Right.
Well, now people are saying, you know, these nut jobs are in the wings, which we'll talk about in a little while. Well, where were the Teamsters? Well, the IBT, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, has announced that in September it had organized in Oakland, California, 40 employees of the Margin Investments LLC, a company that grows and processes medical marijuana.
Oh, yeah. Things are going on out there in Cali.
By ratifying a two-year contract, which includes wages of up to $26 an hour, in the contract's second year, plus vacation, health insurance, and pension benefits, Margin's employees, marijuana gardeners, trimmers, cloners, became members of Teamster Local 70.
Amazing. Yeah. Peter, I'll be in L.A. this weekend. I'm going to investigate a little bit because my friend has his card and he goes to these stores.
You're not going to experiment, are you?
No, I already did it. And it was a success.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chalk up one for organized labor. Tell people what you're going out there for.
I am going out for the, it's a special premiere of the third Jackass movie. The furthest thing from the Night Call show possible. But you know what? I'm going to have a good time.
Well, you should. You know, I'm always missing these notes from Stephanie, who we have not even acknowledged tonight.
Hi, Stephanie. She's our phone screener, and she does a lot of production things, producing.
She's
amazing. So if you want to call. She's the one who answers.
313-298-WRIF.
Open lines right now.
Open lines. We'll be back. Greg from Mount Clemens has an announcement for us, and we'll get that on the air right after these.
You are listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Right now, every time you buy something, anything with your Discover card, you automatically have a chance to win up to $1 million.
So if I bought brown loafers, I could win $1 million?
Yeah.
A riding mower?
That too.
How about my morning coffee?
Uh-huh.
Afternoon coffee?
Sure thing.
Late night coffee?
You bet.
I kind of like coffee.
I can tell. Remember, using your Discover card could make you a millionaire. Learn more at discover.com. It pays to discover. Visit discover.com/giveaway for alternate entry options.
I don't know. Maybe you're one of those individuals who doesn't want to save money on car insurance. Maybe you're an alien from another planet. Maybe on your world, the words saving and money have no meaning. Well, I feel sorry for you. But around here, if you want to save money on car insurance, you switch to Geico. Just like 4 million humans switched to Geico last year. Welcome to Planet Earth.
For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. And Bill, who is up around Taos or something like that, listens to the show, sent this email about Veterans for Peace. It's a very large organization of vets who include men and women, veterans of all eras and duty stations, and going back as far as the Spanish Civil War in the late 30s, World War II, Korean, Vietnam, Gulf, and current Iraq wars, as well as other conflicts. And they put together a banner drop. Let me see.
I think that's where they go out and like over highways and things like that, different places, and put their.
You can't see it.
No.
Can you read that?
I know.
It's too far away. You know what the museum is?
Oh, yeah, and that's in Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., and on the wall of the museum, there is the First Amendment, and so there was a big banner drop. It said, Mr. Obama, end these effing wars.
Wow.
With spelled right out.
Really?
And it said, war is the obscenity, Veterans for Peace. And that's one of the things that have disturbed liberals and progressives and leftists about Barack Obama. Well, I mean, he said this. It's one of the promises he carried out. He said he would end fighting, ongoing conflict in Iraq, which is going absolutely down the tubes, by the way. And in terms of Iraq going to wind up to be pretty much in the orbit of Iran. So all this death, all this destruction, all this money spent, and we said, well, we got rid of Saddam Hussein.
But look where it's gotten us.
Look where it's gotten us.
Back, talk about going backwards.
Yeah, yeah. Here's Kim in Highland. Kim, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Kim. Yep, sorry. I mean, is this the one where you got to push the button to get...
Every time.
I think other people... I was thinking this the other day, Jolene. Maybe we ought to switch places.
You keep threatening.
I run the control board here.
I don't think you can let go of the control of the control board.
Here's Kim in Highland. I got it this time, Kim. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering what you guys thought about Rick Sanchez getting fired from CNN.
You know what? That kind of goes. I mean, let me tell you this.
Give the background.
Okay. Yeah. CNN fired news anchor Rick Sanchez on Friday, a day after he called The Daily Show's Jon Stewart a bigot in a radio show interview, where he also questioned whether Jews should be considered a minority.
And he also said that the broadcasting is completely run by Jews. That's what he said.
There's a lot of
Jews in Berkeley.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So
that's
what?
What
does that mean?
Yeah, right.
Sanchez was whining that someone like Stewart couldn't relate to what he grew up with because, he's a poor Cuban American in Miami and
whatever.
Anyway, this goes back. Here's what I think, Kim. As a broadcaster who says lots of controversial things, as does Jolene, and who, I don't know, I must not be saying anything controversial. I mean, when Doug Podell.
Well, you're not a bigot. You're not a racist.
Well, when Doug Podell was the midday guy and the program director here at WRIF, I would see him on Monday, and he said, whoa, you must have had a hot show. I got about 8 or 10 emails telling me to fire you. So that's on one hand. On the other hand, the companies say if you embarrass us publicly or what have you, you're gone. So I don't know. What do you think, Kim?
I don't know. I was really confused because I'm sure, like you were saying, they had like a contract, but he was on a different, wasn't on CNN. He was on a different show, and it was the radio, and it was his opinion. I mean, I was shocked, actually, because I liked Rick Sanchez, and I was shocked that he even thought that way. I don't know.
It's amazing how people's true feelings come out at the most, you know, just random moment. I was actually on with him on national television.
Yeah.
MSNBC, I think, when he was
on there.
When
he was on there, yeah.
And he was the moderator, host of it all. I always, you know, listen, I can see why he appeals to people because he tries to be like, hey, cats, what's going on? You know, real cool and everything. I saw right through him, though. Back to Florida he goes. He's gone back from National News, Florida. National News, Florida.
How about this, where he'll land? Fox News.
Oh, God,
don't you
please.
Think? I don't know.
That's all he has left. It's his only hope.
Would you?
I know all the stuff that those guys get away with. I know. And, you know, I kind of miss David Schuster on MSNBC. He was fired, and I don't know why. Do you guys know?
I don't even remember.
I don't remember. I remember the name, but I don't watch those shows that much.
In the afternoon.
Yeah. But you know what I want to see, Kim, tomorrow night, or we, yeah, we're still in Sunday. Tomorrow night, Monday, 11 o'clock, the Comedy Network, the Daily Show.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be, because, you know, that one of the things that Sanchez hates Jon Stewart, because at least three times in the past few months, Stewart has used these Sanchez clips to mock him.
And, well, he's easy to mock if he really.
Yeah. Apparently, I don't get that. I'm reading this. He says, including one where Sanchez mispronounced the word annals in a story about Vice President Joe Biden.
You might want to read your scripts
the host
first.
Kept saying, oh, you're just saying this stuff. You don't like Jon Stewart because he's always mocking you. And he's like, no, I really don't. Yeah. I really believe this stuff, you know.
Well, we'll see. Let's. I'm going to check it out tomorrow. How about you?
Oh, definitely.
All right. Thank you, Kim. Appreciate your call. Oh, I forgot. I'm sorry. I promised Greg from Mount Clemens that we were going to get an announcement from him. Some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. Okay. Stephanie's giving me an important message. Thank you. Hey, by the way, there are some open lines, and if you want to weigh in on the Sanchez thing, it's okay. I mean, I guess, you know what?
All opinions are welcome. It doesn't mean we're.
I wonder if those people. I wonder if those people on CNN are my AFTRA, my union brothers and sisters.
I don't know.
If so, I'm definitely for Rick.
And you know what? We always, okay, all right, there you go. No matter what he says, Peter, no, you can't say that.
Yeah.
You're not for his personal, but okay.
But
that
is scary for broadcasters. And that goes back to the Andrew Scherville thing, the guy who
he's
was
just
stalking.
An attorney general.
Yeah. That, but what he did, again, back to the guy who was stalking essentially the gay student president of the University of Michigan Student Council. But it first came up what this assistant attorney general was putting on his own website about this young man. And, I mean, it was weird. He's calling him a bigot and a Nazi, and, I mean, you know.
He's crazy. This guy's crazy.
I think so.
Also, a lot of other things have gone on during the week, so if there's anything that you have in mind out there, give us a call.
Yeah, some open lines, too. Here's Greg in Mount Clemens. Greg, we kept promising, and now you are on the air. What's happening?
How you doing? Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, very good. I'm on speakerphone. I'm associated with Marvin Sherwitz, and tomorrow there's going to be a protest rally in Royal Oak at about 7 o'clock tomorrow evening at their city hall. The city of Royal Oak is going to be banning medical marijuana to be used in land use, so that means patients can't use or cultivate or grow even in their own homes.
Well, how can they do that? It's the Michigan law that you can...
Well, unfortunately, what they're citing right now is they're getting information from federal agencies that are telling them to ban out by land use zones, and they're taking the federal presence with their laws and instead of the state enacted majority of 63% of the voters. So tomorrow what we're asking for is we're asking for not just Royal Oak residents or patients and caregivers, but all Americans, all Michiganders, to please, this is your vote. This is your vote or initiative vote to please come out and support this. There's an opportunity to amend or stop the city commission from enacting this legislation. If not, there'll be a referendum. I'm quite sure, which we are planning. And I'd like to at least have the signatures in place. If that does, if the ban does go in effect, that we can actually have the signatures right then and there, right, ready for them tomorrow.
Well, let's go over the details
again. What's up with Royal Oak?
Yeah, it's 7 p.m. at City Hall.
Yeah, well, it's a city commission vote meeting tomorrow at 7:30. However, we'd like to protest and picket tomorrow evening, and at about 6:30 to 7 o'clock.
Yeah, Greg, you're telling us all these different times. Let's put out a timer. 6:30. You want people there at 6:30?
Yeah, I would like everyone there at 6:30, please.
Okay, and this is at the Royal Oak City Hall.
Correct. Yeah, I believe the address is 221 William Street. That's Royal Oak. Yeah,
right by the farmer's market.
Right by the farmer's market, by the library, and all of that.
Hey, Peter, right. Marvin, I haven't heard that name for a while.
And by the way, neither Greg nor Jalene is stuttering. That is, in fact, how he identifies himself. Oh, I see Marvin around. I saw him at a Luddite show down at the...
I haven't seen him for years.
Down at the Lager House. You got to go to these funky bars downtown.
Well, last time I saw him was at the Rainbow Farms. Remember the one that ATF went in and...
Yeah.
Rated. Got rid of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Were you experimenting?
He was there. Already succeeded, Peter. I keep trying to tell you.
All right, Greg, thank you very much. Tell M Squared that if he would let me know about these things a little in advance, I'd put them on my website calendar. But thank you very much. Appreciate it. And if you want to find out events like this, other things happening around town, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Go down the left, where else? And there'll be a little skyline of Detroit. Yeah, you got it, huh? All right.
I was a little slow on the uptake on that one.
Here's David in Detroit, 313-298-WRIF. Thank you for joining us. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
We're good.
Oh, good. I'm just driving back from up north, and I really just turned on the station and didn't know what the different topics were, so Stephanie informed me. And I guess it's ironic. I'm coming back from a Constitution class up there, and met a lot of great people, good time. And I guess to sort of expand on what Greg was talking about, you know, it seems to me like, of course, if Michigan voters voted, this is what they wanted. It seems to me like the complaint is that the feds are coming in, throwing their weight around. And I think based on what I've learned and picked up this weekend, what we have to do as people is to remind our sheriffs the power they have, that they can stop these feds right there in their county at the county level. And so I think what's happened over the country is that the sheriffs have sort of relinquished their role and their power to, let's say, the feds or even like the state.
David, you sound like this is Idaho, not Michigan. Come on, man. You know that federal law trumps state law. I mean, and there's this Marijuana Stamp Tax Act and all these other things. And in fact, I am surprised. Probably it's just political that the feds haven't tried to stop every single one of these medical marijuana places over the last 10 years or so. But, I mean, I'm glad they haven't, and I'm glad that we are moving towards an eventual legalization of it. But, you know, what is it, local imposition or whatever it's called, that has a bad history.
Well, let's be clear, though. The feds do have what they refer to as a supremacy clause.
Right.
But that supremacy clause only applies to the 18 enumerated privileges that we grant the feds. And let's keep in mind that the feds were created by the people and through the states.
Yep.
So there is a limit. And that which is not specifically outlined in the Constitution is up to the people and up to the states. So, you know, does this fall into that category of the supremacy clause? And I guess that's where the argument would be. I would say not, just based on what I've read and just my, you know, I don't know, 5-6 years of studying this and going over it.
Well, the problem is that if the locals are resisting federal policies that we enjoy or that we support, well, then let's hear it. If it's the other way around, in other words, you know, I don't think we liked that kind of activity by the local sheriffs in the 1950s and 1960s with the, you know, the civil rights laws, right?
Well, absolutely, but let's keep in mind too that we're talking about following the law. We're not talking about rogue sheriffs, because obviously there's laws against those kinds of people as well. I mean, you know, there's repercussions for those types of sheriffs. But I was speaking in general, just a sheriff that's abiding by the law And to understand that he has the power to stop the feds from doing, let's say, crooked or scandalous kind of stuff. That's what I was referring to. I mean, I know you can go all the way around with this and say there's corruption on every level, and, you know, and that can be abused by anybody. But just on the surface, the power of the sheriff is, you know, can be a positive thing if it's done right. And so I'm hoping that, in this case, anyway, that our county sheriff, and I guess that would be Oakland County,
right,
does the right thing by the people who did vote.
I don't mean to sound like a dope, but all of a sudden I can't remember who the Oakland County sheriff is.
Is it still Burchard?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I was a dope. All right. Thank you very much for weighing in on that, David. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. A month before California voters are going to vote on whether to legalize marijuana.
Yes.
In California, they got a ballot initiative that would legalize it. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a bill essentially that puts those that are caught possessing small amounts of marijuana sort of the same as if you're caught speeding on the freeway.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And he's against this ballot measure, this Prop 19. In other words, he thinks that it should be kept illegal. What this would do, let me say what's been done first. The new law, he says, is largely administrative, and it would change the crime of possession from a misdemeanor to an infraction, the lowest level of offense under state law. And that's just extraordinary when you think about it as well. I mean, the millions of people who the state share, the city governments and the state governments and the federal governments, whose lives they've ruined because people wanted to change their consciousness.
Or feel better.
Yeah. Or whatever. You know what? It is nobody's business if I do, as the old song goes. And if we're finally, after how much billions and billions of dollars have been wasted on this war on drugs, just so people wouldn't get wasted.
Yeah.
Even though
they're still getting high.
Yeah.
No one ever stopped.
You know, there's something about it, no matter how draconian, that's the word. How strict the laws are, the penalties, people still get high. I mean, people get high or have drugs in like Iran and China, and they get executed. I mean, if you knew you could get executed for smoking a doobie.
That might be a deterrent.
Well, it's not
to
everybody.
Not.
I mean, it'd be a deterrent to me.
Yeah, you got that right.
Yeah. So right now, possession of up to an ounce is punishable by $100. Offenders would not be arrested, or they'd get a ticket, or they wouldn't have a criminal record. Well, that's good.
Yeah, sure is.
That's good. Here's David, who just called, was from Detroit. Meg Whitman, who was the CEO of eBay.
Yeah, and now she's running for governor.
Trying to buy California. The California governorship.
She is buying it. And
$119 million of her own money.
Oh, my gosh. How bad do you want that power? Wasn't it being the CEO of eBay enough for you, lady?
No.
And now what comes out this week, Peter?
Oh, yeah, that she had...
illegal immigrant.
Yeah, working for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She claims she didn't know, and she fired her right away when she told her. Whatever.
Yeah.
If you really cared, you would have looked a little further into those papers, right?
Here's what she said recently, though. Fresno, which is the city's the state of California's fifth largest city, she says, Fresno looks like Detroit. It's awful.
Yeah, well, you know what? Up yours, Meg Whitman.
Yeah.
That's about as far as I'm going to be as low as you are.
There you go. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Andy. Andy's in Leonard. Welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air. Hey, Andy. Andy.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead. Shut your radio 100% off, please.
It's off.
Okay, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I just, in Detroit, there's been a lot of media coverage about the 13 auto workers that were fired.
Oh, yeah. Or did they fire them? Finally, the guys that were caught... drinking and smoking weed?
Yes, they fired him.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And I just think, you know, the media here has been all over it. I mean, on sports radio, on whatever media outlet there is.
Really?
Sports radio's talking about it?
These guys have run out of sports to talk about, clearly.
And I just think that, you know, they're doing a disservice to the area. I've never been a auto worker. I've never been a member of a union, but I just think that, you know, the union wages support our economy, and to attack these people in spite of the fact that non-union workers are doing this, the same type of activities, which I don't endorse, and you know, there's no attention paid to it. It's just the evil union worker who's getting paid a fair wage.
You got it both, and good choice of a phrase too, a fair wage, because what it's all about is driving all of our wages down. And the linchpin, the key to all of the wage structure in the United States are union wages. I mean, particularly among industrial workers, but even within the middle class, it's what you expect. And as those get driven downward, now, I have a story on that, even about libraries, if you can imagine that, after our break. But yeah, no, it's they know that it's like throwing red meat. Like, gee, look at they're getting more money than they should, and they're drinking and smoking reefer. You know, I'm actually disappointed in the union if they took that sitting down. I mean, getting fired. I don't know, you know, whether I hope the UAW didn't agree to it, because people should not be doing that. And if you contravene work rules, there's penalties. I mean, you say, all right, suspend them. They have to go to rehab. They have to maybe get blood tested, mm-hmm. and all of that. But to bounce them out of there is really, I think, unacceptable. And I probably shouldn't say that. But what happened to the old concept of the wildcat strike? You know, all the workers just saying, hey, man, we're supporting our fellow workers.
Yeah.
Damn. All right. Thank you very much, Andy. Thank you for bringing that up. Other opinions on that, welcome. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is you driving.
If only there was a way to hear a song I like on the radio and buy it later when I'm online.
This is you driving the new 2011 Ford Edge with available HD radio featuring iTunes tagging.
I always liked this song. And now it's mine.
Don't you seem much happier? You do to me.
I think you're right. I am much happier.
Available HD radio with exclusive iTunes tagging.
Hear it, tag it, have it.
Only in the new Ford Edge. Drive one. Driving while distracted can result in loss of control. Only use devices when it is safe.
We know you love to save money. That's why we know you'll love MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Each weekday, MotorCityDailyDeal.com sends an unbelievable deal right to your inbox. We're working with local businesses to make sure these deals save you 50 to 85% off. Restaurants, salons, spas, events, and more. You get incredible deals from great local businesses like these.
Doc Sports Retreat in Livonia, Haunted Blake's in Armada, Napier's Kennel Shop in Birmingham, and Dot Pub in Wyandotte.
And these deals are so good, they're only available for 24 hours. That's right, just 24 hours, then they're gone. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's your new local way to save on all the cool things you love to eat, see, and do. Log on, sign up, and save with MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com. MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. Julie and Jordan, are you ready?
I'm ready to rock.
All right. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, I say that because we haven't had any international calls. And I'm not talking about Canada, although we welcome our Canadian friends. But
absolutely.
At 1 a.m., I'm going to be airing an interview with Pulitzer Prize nominee and syndicated cartoonist Ted Rall, R-A-L-L. And he has got a book called The Anti-American Manifesto.
He's something.
That's rude.
Check him out. But he's cool, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? He's a friend of mine on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, check him out. He has some really cool things to say.
Or you can just go to Rall, RALL.com. I mean, that's the first question I ask him. I said, anti-American? I mean, people used to be called un-American, right?
But right.
Anti-American, wow. And then a pal of mine, Steve Babson, who's the co-author of this book, I always say this, right? I'm always apologizing for these things that actually...
These unsexy titles?
Yeah, The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, who was a Detroit lawyer who lived from, I think it was 1906 to 1996. And Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the struggle for labor and civil rights. And this man, this defense attorney, was everywhere from the 1930s through the 1990s, including involved in these trials around the Attica Uprising, 1971 Attica Uprising and all that. So he's an amazing character. And Steve Babson and Dave Riddle and Dave Elsela, labor activists, have written an incredible book about him. And there's going to be an opening on everything. Oh, actually, I have my own little website here, so I can go to the Detroit calendar. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and our whole computer system shot, isn't it?
It's been shot all day here.
Yeah, it's not working.
I mean, it's functioning about half-assed.
Right. let's see here. Here is Dirk. Dirk's in Madison Heights. Dirk, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Hey, Jalene. How you doing tonight?
How you
doing? Hey, Dirk.
All right, I got a question for you. Well, actually, a comment. All right, when I grew up, I went to a Catholic school, and we used to say the Pledge of Allegiance, okay?
Yeah.
Now, when did we become a democracy? I thought we were a republic. And
well,
the republic for which it stands.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
What happened to that? They're supposed
What do you mean?
They're supposed to be looking out for us. We elect them to speak for us, and it seems like they just rob and take from us.
That's
my biggest problem with the national or the Pledge of Allegiance is the under God part that these dudes decided to put in what
54.
54, yeah.
They didn't want to. Were afraid they would confuse us with the godless communists.
Oh God!
Yeah.
Okay.
But are we not a republic?
Well, the form it's Republican form. Yeah, not the party, but and people are elected in a democratic way. I'm not quite sure. People always used to say. Remember, this is a republic, not a democracy, which I'm
Out I'm a libertarian.
Wow.
Are you one of those, are you a bagger?
A bagger? less government, less big brother in my life, you know. Quit taking my Social Security, let me keep it. If it ain't going to be there for me.
You're going to have your Social Security.
Well,
sitting something.
But I'll tell you, it's those Republican right-wingers who are going to take away your Social Security. You're not old enough to get Social Security.
No, I grew up a Democrat. My family's all Democrat. And then I started following the Libertarian Party. And I I'm kind of both ways. You know, I'm kind of in between the two of them. But as for legalization, they should have did that a long time ago.
Well, that's libertarian. I agree
little
with
baby
that.
Steps.
But you
got
to remember, these, you know, people are facing, we the people are facing some very troubling times. And even though things like manufacturing has grown steadily upward for the last 14 months and the stock market's up, there's still real trouble in our neighborhoods and in our families.
We got a long way to go.
Yeah. Well, there's some thought that we ain't coming back or it's going to be a long time because as long as the people that can run things can make money, what do they care if there's 15 million unemployed or what have you?
Yeah.
Right? All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call, Dirk. And here, this is what I'm getting at. So you got these people that say, get the government off our back and all that. Well, they don't mean all of it, because certainly among the teabaggers that are quite a bit older demographically, I mean, the average demographic for them is considerably higher than the population at large, they're not going to get rid of Social Security or Medicare. But the son of Ron Paul, Rand Paul, who I assume...
Is that his son?
Yeah. You didn't know that?
No. In fact, why did I never put these together?
And I thought probably named him after Ayn Rand, that horrible writer with that terrible philosophy.
And people always try to throw that at us here and there. Don't we get that a few times a year?
What? Oh, how?
Ayn Rand.
Yeah. But so I said that purposely as a...
deterrent?
No, as a provocative statement. Yeah. But Republican U.S. Senate candidate, this is in Kentucky, Rand Paul, and by the way, he's not named after Ayn Rand.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, his name might be Randall or something like that. But anyway, said the age of eligibility for Social Security and Medicare may need to be raised for future recipients. So grandma and grandpa, or you, if you're, you know, if you're that age, you're okay. But what he's talking about is that we're looking at this enormous debt, right, that Bush, the hole that Bush dug us into, the necessity to bail out these companies, and trying to bring it back through a stimulus that probably isn't even big enough to really do it, because as has been noted, here's the stimulus going on. And what it's done probably has just saved us from having unemployment that's double what it is. But what we're interested in is having employment figures, or let's say unemployment figures, that are maybe a third of what they are currently, certainly here in Michigan. Although we're not number one in unemployment anymore, Nevada is the big unemployment state. So here we got this deal, and Rand Paul, like his daddy, is a
did I miss that?
Did you ever hear George Carlin talking about? He's another thing I hated. Those guys, that grown men, that talk about my daddy. He says, my daddy this, my daddy that. And he says, F your daddy.
All right, never mind. Remember GW? Saddam tried to kill my daddy.
Oh, yeah. He was like my daddy.
Yeah, I'm going to finish what my daddy started.
Yeah, well, he hasn't. And he left us with these wars.
A big-ass mess.
A big-ass mess. A big-ass deficit.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're putting this this TARP fund, the Troubled Asset Relief Fund, isn't that? I don't have it in front of me. And that was all Bush, because Bush represented big capital. And that's what I don't understand. So you got all these teabaggers that think that they are, for the little guy and what have you. And everything behind the teabaggers, everything behind the Republican Party is big capital.
What you said before just could not be any further from the truth.
Yeah. One of the things I saw that I thought was interesting, Frank Rich in the New York Times, I didn't print that out.
Didn't we print that out? Yeah.
He was saying that, what's that woman, O'Connell, that kind of flake from Delaware?
Christine O'Donnell.
Yeah, Christine O'Donnell. That she is this real diversion, because she, what she looks like is sort of this nice, hapless.
She looks like a sorority girl.
Yeah, but you know, she's had the same troubles that a lot of Americans had. She says kind of
Palin-ish things.
Palin-esque. But what Frank Rich says, it really masks what is behind this all, and what it is big capital. I mean, it's the Koch brothers, the billionaires that are funding all this. It's Karl Rove that's funneling these tens of millions of dollars into Republican candidates. And that's what they're after. They're after, like Dirk was saying, they're after your Social Security. And they're not going to take it away from the current crowd, to be sure. They'd be out on their ass in about, a Detroit second, right?
Yeah.
But they're saying, well, where are we going to get this money from to cover, for instance, if we don't extend the tax on the ultra wealthy? This is what Obama wants to do. 98% of us continue to have the tax break. The 2% at the top that can afford it the most, that have just made out like literal bandits, they're the ones that would start paying a little bit more of the freight. And I stress little, because they would just be going back to the tax rates that were present under the Clinton administration, where they made all their damn money in the first place.
That's true. I always say this. He was a good Republican.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah.
And by good, you know what I mean.
Paul Krugman, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, says House Republicans released their pledge to America. This was a week or so ago. And he says, in essence, they say deficits are a terrible thing. Let's make them much bigger. The document repeatedly condemns federal debt 16 times by his count. And he says, but the main substantive policy proposal is to make the Bush tax cut permanent, which independent estimates say would add about $3.7 trillion to the debt over the next decade, about $700 billion more than the Obama administration's tax proposal. Mm. So here is what the deal is. They want to continue to have, well, what is it? What do we always say? It's the melting pot. Those on the bottom get burned and the scum rises to the top.
Yeah. Right.
But, so we're going to be out $3.7 trillion if we don't start taxing the ultra wealthy appropriately. So what are they going to do? Well, where are they going to get the money? Well, they're going to, like, get rid of Social Security. Let's say they won't do that. But say they make it, you got to be 70.
Right.
So that means they're essentially taking 5 years away from everybody that's going to retire whenever they would get their hands near the levers of power, which I hope, you know, would never be the case. Let's see. Total income was $2.74 trillion less during the eight Bush years than if incomes had stayed at the 2000 level. The number of people reporting incomes of $200,000 or more but legally paying no federal income tax skyrocketed in the second Bush term. It goes on and on like that. So that's what it's all about. These people have you, the average person, in their gun sights, and that an average person, even a middle class, even an upper middle class people, I mean, are people really this dumb?
Yes.
Okay.
Clearly.
Should we quote Mark Twain? Consider the intelligence of the average man and realize 50% are even dumber.
Okay. Shudder.
Right. They've been reading all this insane stuff because the head whack job, the head teabagger, Beck, brings up these obscure... Where in the world could this guy, who was a shock jock, where could he come with these obscure texts? Like
he sits there at night thinking, what inflammatory thing can I say tomorrow?
But he's all over this thing, and excuse me if I'm not pronouncing the last name correct, Frederick Bastiat's. The law, published in 1850, proclaims that taxing people to pay for schools or roads was government-sanctioned theft. How do you get it, then? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, in 1981, by an anti-communist crusader who says the founding fathers had not intended a separation of church and state. Does this guy ever read the Federalist paper? All told,
he just makes things up.
The teabaggers are arguing here, quote, a vision of the country where government's role is to protect private property against taxes as much as against thieves, where religion plays a bigger role in public life, where any safety net is unconstitutional. So no safety nets. You go back to the way it was in the early 30s when people were dying on the streets of exposure, where you went to the poorhouse, where you were just gone. That's the way back to prosperity. And the way back to prosperity for markets is to be left free from regulation.
Mm.
Remember what happened when it was free from regulation in the 19th century?
Wow. Nothing good.
Yeah, yeah. So these people are crazy.
Yeah.
I mean,
really?
The people uttering, there's always been this level, this layer of these totally insane people and that are all into these obscure economists and these theories of the Constitution and what have you. But the fact that they would have anything like a mass following and that they were able to be mobilized by some wacky TV personality says, folks, we are in major trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. I said our show hadn't been international for a while. Here's Rick calling from Ontario, and thanks for making the show international, Rick. Where are you calling from?
Chatham, Ontario.
Chatham, eh? Okay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. You're talking about them coming for Social Security. They're not really coming for Social Security. I know following the HR directive being signed in Washington, there is one that's been signed where they can come and they can take everyone's 401k and because it's registered with the government, you've given it to the government.
Wait, Rick, are you a Canadian or are you an American just vacationing in Chatham?
No, I'm Canadian, but what affects you affects us.
Yeah.
And it's like dominoes. When one falls, the rest are not far behind.
This, Rick, sounds like right-wing propaganda. You'd have to show me this. Where the government?
Do you get Fox News in Canada?
What you got to do is go to the White House's website and look up the HR directives that have been signed. You'll find it right there.
The HR, the human relations? Is that what the HR in this case is?
Or, as far as your Social Security goes, you're always going to get it. how much you're going to get is going to change. That's all.
Right. Well, by the way, I didn't say that we could. There's a number of ways that we could deal with Social Security. For one thing, cut the military budget by about two-thirds. Speaking of libertarians and Ron Paul, Ron Paul wants to bring the 700 to 800 U.S. bases back here, end all these wars.
That's fine.
Stop preparation for nuclear war.
Yep.
We would have no problems whatsoever. The other thing you could do, just a very simple thing, is and talked about this before, is eliminate the cap on the withholding tax. So right now it's about $105,000. So if you're making $28 million a year, which some people do in the upper 1%, then you would you only pay on $105,000. Just take the cap off, problem solved. Hey?
Yeah. But the other thing I wanted to mention was now I've slipped my mind because you start talking about the cap.
All right. Well, what? You got it? No. Okay. We'll talk about it another time. Call us back. 313-298-WRIF. You know, I never mentioned, I said I was going to talk about the libraries.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I never did. Here's the deal. A private company in Maryland has taken over public libraries in ailing cities in California, Oregon, Tennessee, and Texas, growing into the country's fifth largest library system. It's called Library Systems and Services. And it's hired in Santa Clarita, California, to run a system in a relatively healthy city. They have a $4 million deal to run the three libraries, and it's a chance for the company to demonstrate that a dose of private management can be good for communities, whatever their financial situation. Now, what is broke in the Santa Clarita, California library system? I don't know. But here is the deal. Their Frank A. Pizzenti, the outsourcing company's chief executive, says there's this American flag apple pie thing about libraries. Yeah, you know why? Because it's rooted in our communities, Frank. He's pledged to save $1 million a year in Santa Clarita, mainly by cutting overhead and replacing unionized employees. Yeah. So this son of a bitch and his company, I'm mad about this, is going to come into a Maryland firm coming into California. They're going to destroy the livelihood of these people that have committed their lives to a community library and expect to be compensated in a manner that is consistent with their training and their commitment. This is the race to the bottom, folks.
Right, yeah.
This is the race to the bottom. And what happens, and I hear that sometimes, what I call the party of resentment, and you say, why should those librarians be making $50,000 a year? You know, I only make $8 an hour. And, you're going to have your way because pretty soon, you know, everybody will be making $8 an hour if, you know, in fact, we're very lucky. Actually, I forgot we had an email here. If our little machine will cooperate, which I guess it's not. Can you see if you can get that up? It's from Al. It says health
okay.
System. Yeah. So look out for those guys. Here is Paul in Plymouth. Paul, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You are on the air.
Hey, Peter. I wanted to comment about the medical marijuana dispensaries, but I want to throw something in real quick about Social Security.
Sure.
You mentioned the withholding cap. Most people don't know that you are only taxed up to $90,000 in income on Social Security. So someone who does make $1 million or over $90,000 only pays to $90,000.
Well, now it's up to $105,000 now.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
If we were just remove that, that would save Social Security for more years.
Well, yeah, but I mean, by the way, Social Security is not threatened. I mean, that's another one of these Republican lies that somehow that it's, that it's in danger. I mean, there was this huge surplus that Bush blew, you know, in general, in the whole, he so mismanaged the economy and saddled us with all this.
I wanted to mention about these medical marijuana dispensaries.
Sure.
There have, just in the past 5 or 6 weeks, two medical marijuana dispensaries have been raided by the Oakland County Sheriff's Task Force. One was in Ferndale.
Okay.
The other one is in Hillsdale. And they went in with their masks, you know, machine gun toting officers and, you know, knocked down the patients and staff and went through the whole place and took everything. The, you know, TVs, computers, security cameras, everything. all the records, and then they hit all the employees' houses and all the owners, anyone who had anything to affiliation with the dispensaries.
Wow.
Their homes were raided, and they were arrested as well for various, I don't know, felonies, they say. And it's, I guess, Bouchard came out with one of his prosecutors and said, this is going to be our test case so that we have some sort of precedent in the state of Michigan.
So Bouchard is for this?
For the raids.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah, we had a caller on before. I guess it was David from Detroit, who was saying that he was hoping that the local sheriffs would interpose their authority in front of the feds, but I guess they're not trying. Yeah, can you imagine this? I mean, listen, let's be honest. I don't think that everybody that's got a medical marijuana card is doing it solely for medical purposes, that it's a way to circumvent the way to enjoy the properties that marijuana smokers want to attain. And why the hell shouldn't they? What business is it of the government if people are not endangering others, like by driving? Driving intoxicated is not acceptable in any regard. But as I said before, the fact that we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars, I think some estimates are almost $1 trillion, creating this repressive prohibition that has hurt so many and has been this massive transfer of wealth. I mean, because that's what it's all about. I mean, these conservatives are always talking about, where the government's taking our money. Well, they don't. The biggest transfer of wealth, of course, through our taxes, goes to the war industries, of which provide virtually no services for us whatsoever, and in fact, probably, because of our intervention all over the world, which then it's a loop, it's a Mobius strip, necessitates that, because then people begin to hate us and attack us, and we get involved in wars and the possibility of wars with Russia and China and all that. So it's an unworkable system that's beginning to crash down around us, I'd say.
You know, Sheriff Bouchard, he, in a statement with his prosecutors, they had some big PR stunt, compared the marijuana clinics to an organized crime ring. And, quoted this as a great victory. This will be a test case for Michigan. It's kind of sad.
I missed all this. That's weird.
In Plymouth here, we have, there's a doctor here that has opened a clinic, and he went around and put all his signs up that he was going to have this clinic here, and the city did the same thing as Royal Oak is doing now. They created an ordinance against it because federal law says they can. And the only way to fix that, really, is that if each state gets together and we get, ballots out or petitions out there to get a vote by the American people on marijuana as a whole. That's the only way you'll change federal law.
Yeah, because, I guess that's it. But, again, the spineless legislators who wouldn't dare wouldn't vote their conscience. They just go in the back room and get high, and then,
Right.
It's like the Republican gays that vote against gay rights.
Yeah, we know what's up with
that. All right, thank you, Paul.
This is the one you want me to read.
Yeah.
This is a good one. Hello, Peter. You have been saying for years that the U.S. is the only industrialized country in the world without an adequate health care system. Give credit where credit's due. The Republicans and a lot of Democrats have been working for years to eliminate that distinction by turning us into a deindustrialized country. Allen, Ann Arbor. Excellent point.
There you go. 313-298-WRIF. Some open lines for you. Here's David in Detroit. And Leslie, is this the same David that was on earlier?
No, this is a different David.
Okay, go ahead.
There's a lot of Davids in Detroit.
A lot of Davids,
right?
In Detroit. Good. Because we one time only. Go ahead. What's up?
Can I just ask you to repeat what you said about the soldiers that are fighting over in foreign other land?
Which part?
What you just said to the other caller?
Remind me. I mean, I said lots of things.
So then, they're over there spending billions of dollars.
Right.
Fighting wars.
Yeah, it's part of a military-industrial complex. So, in other words, in order to have the economy keep generating profits, that there has to be this massive transfer of wealth from people like you and me to the military and war industries. But it also necessitates wars from time to time. So wars become essentially wars for wars to justify military spending, and it chews up other countries, chews up our soldiers, and we wind up being less secure than when we started.
No, that is a complete lie.
A lie? Wait, hold on, wait, David. You may think I'm mistaken, but it's not a lie.
Okay, well, first things first, you're talking to a soldier right now. Okay, I've served in Iraq, I've served in Guantanamo Bay, I'm about to serve again and all that, defending this country.
Mm.
Okay? The thing that soldiers are doing over there, one, the freedoms that we give here, we're letting people that can't fight because their government is so suppressive that they would kill them with just looking the wrong way, would just kill them instantly and not think another thing about it.
But wait a minute. The war in Iraq was based on an absolute and total lie. There was no weapons of mass destruction.
And
the rest of those war criminals in the Bush administration knew that to be the case. They sent guys like you out to risk your life, to lose your life, to lose arms and legs, to not give you proper VA facilities.
When you get back.
Yeah, and to send you into this meat grinder time after time after time. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have lost their lives. A couple million are internal refugees, and what's turning out is this al-Maliki government is going to wind up to be an ally of Iran. How in the hell does that defend our freedom?
How is that defending the freedom? Because while soldiers over there paying the ultimate price, they're keeping those idiots from coming back to this country with nuclear weapons, blowing up another building.
Wait. Iraq, David, are you reading history? They had no weapons of mass destruction. They had no capacity
to do it.
They had no nukes whatsoever. This was a lie that Bush made up.
I'm not saying Bush didn't lie about going into Iraq for whatever reason. But the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, it's not being fought against the Iraqi people.
Well, they sure are the ones that got killed. I mean, there's, depending on who's...
Of people who died were Iraqi, innocent Iraqi civilians, and they're still dying.
And the country has been destroyed by the United States.
Where are you from?
What?
Who's killing those Iraqi people?
Well, there's twofold. One, it unleashed the civil war, of course, but also all of it occurred because of the U.S. invasion and occupation, right? That wasn't going on before, because if George Bush would have allowed the inspectors from the United Nations to continue their work and to show that there was no weapons of mass destruction, it's very probable that Saddam Hussein would have been overthrown by his own generals, and probably all of this would have been saved. That everything you've experienced was, which must have been pretty terrible, and could be, more of the same, never would have occurred.
No, that's not true, because Saddam Hussein had a check and balance system. Anybody that spoke up against him, he killed instantly.
That's right, but he was beginning, well, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't even argue. I mean, I'm sorry that you're in this situation. I think you've probably seen things and had to experience things that no one should, and it's no one's being critical of you. You didn't send yourself there.
We're more critical of, we're talking about the government, about you an individual soldier, David.
Right. And, that you follow orders, right?
Stayed out of there.
What?
I could have stayed out of there. I could have got out of the military and never set foot in Iraq. I volunteered. I raised my own hand to defend this country, defend people's right to freedom of speeches and everything else, and prevent these people. The people that are dying over there and getting killed, they're not getting killed by, the other Iraqis. They're getting killed by people from Syria, people from Iran, all these extreme... terrorists are using them to kill them.
Well,
David, I have a question for you. And I know you're probably still talking, so I hope you hear me. Are you telling me you never, ever, once in all of your time there, saw one innocent civilian killed by, let's say, soldiers?
By U.S. soldiers?
Yeah.
Don't know. The missions I was on was to keep the roads, get equipment up to soldiers.
Well, okay.
Okay.
Let's leave it at that.
I was just curious. I know it's happened.
Good luck. I hope you stay out of harm's way.
Yeah.
I hope this all ends quickly.
I mean, get out of it.
I mean, it's politicians everywhere, and it's the common man and woman that pays the cost.
I mean, I understand, you know, wanting to defend your country, but not based upon a lie. If there's going to, you know, and really, Peter, when it comes to wars...
Yeah.
We talk about what wars were necessary. What's your answer to that?
What wars were necessary?
Yeah.
World War II.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yep.
All the rest were either land grabs or made up. World War One, made up.
Total.
Vietnam.
BS.
Made up.
Yep.
Iraq wars, both of them, made up.
Believe it.
I mean, the causes for them. Yeah. You know, that's what countries do. That's what nation states do.
This is the way of the world. It has been for a long time.
Yep.
People are just so used to it that they just go along with it automatically, you know?
Hey, Robert from Ann Arbor, I want to hear your story about who's a marijuana patient. Your dispensary got, got robbed.
Oh,
and also,
my.
John from Toledo wants to ask about my opinion about Iraq. We'll get to that, and Jalene Jordan will give hers as well when we return.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Mid-Michigan, if you've had credit problems and are in need of an auto loan, Lasco Ford in Fenton has good news. You're approved. Right now, you can go to LascoFord.com and get pre-approved. And if Lasco Ford can't get you an auto loan, they'll pay you $1,000 in cash. Lasco Ford has national lenders that will offer auto loans at affordable payments, like a 2008 Ford Fusion for only $149 a month. Lasco Ford also has programs for customers that may have had foreclosures, loan modifications, or repossessions in the past. And this month at Lasco Ford, you can choose from zero down or deferred payments for up to 6 months. If you have had credit problems or have been turned down by another dealer, call Lasco Ford today and get approved. If you're turned down, they'll pay you $1,000 cash. You can visit Lasco Ford to get pre-approved 24 hours a day at Lasco Ford. Open until 8 p.m. weekdays, Saturday 9 to 5, or visit LascoFord.com.
We know you love to save money. That's why we know you'll love MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Each weekday, MotorCityDailyDeal.com sends an unbelievable deal right to your inbox. We're working with local businesses to make sure these deals save you 50 to 85% off. Restaurants, salons, spas, events, and more. You get incredible deals from great local businesses like these.
Napier's Kennel Shop in Birmingham. Andiamo Novi Theater in Novi. Strawberry Moon in Ferndale, Cup.Cake in Royal Oak, and Deluxe Lounge in Detroit.
And these deals are so good, they're only available for 24 hours. That's right, just 24 hours, then they're gone. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's your new local way to save on all the cool things you love to eat, see, and do. Log on, sign up, and save with MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com. MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
Are you interested in a broadcast or media-related career? Want to get ahead of the rest, be more marketable, more innovative? Attend the 2010 Broadcasting Career Builder Conference, BCBC, and learn how to be successful. BCBC features great sessions, a career fair, and lunch, all on Friday, October 29th at Lansing Community College's West Campus. Visit www.mybcbc.com for rates and information. That's mybcbc.com. This message sponsored by the MAB and MAB Foundation.
Elise, come on, it's game day. You've got all weekend to study.
Jen, this has nothing to do with studying. I've got to work. The way the economy is, I figure I'll be working for the next century just to pay off these student loans.
Well, you know...
I know. You joined the National Guard, so your college is completely paid for. Yes, you've mentioned it a couple thousand times.
The National Guard Scholarship covers up to 100% of your tuition. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Michigan National Guard. Aired by the Michigan Association of Broadcasters and this station.
How many chances in a lifetime do you have to get in on the ground level of an emerging technology? Not many, right? Well, right now, you can. thanks to the Michigan Institute of Aviation and Technology in Canton. The emerging field right now is renewable energy, and it's exploding with potential. Let MIAT show you the exciting opportunities that currently exist so you can have the job security you're looking for. The Michigan Institute of Aviation and Technology will teach you the hands-on precision skills necessary to fast-track your career in this emerging technology. Call 1-800-NEW-GOAL and discover how to take your career to new heights, or go online to miat.edu. Don't let this incredible career opportunity pass you by. Set up an appointment today and find out how you can get in on the early stages of the alternative energy generation. MIAT offers financial aid for those who qualify. Call MIAT today. 1-800-NEW-GOAL. That's 1-800-639-4625. Or click on miat.edu for more details.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, it's the final segment. Give us your calls. We just had a little bit of a go-around with a soldier that served in Iraq. Winston writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I shouldn't patronize these people. They enlisted, they weren't drafted, and guys like that one are desperate to rationalize some patriotic purpose to their own self-destructive action in what essentially is a war crime. Well, yeah. I mean, George W. Bush and Rumsfeld, the rest of those guys are under international law.
Cheney,
thank you. Guilty of what's called a crime against peace and belong in the docket at the International Criminal Tribunal, I'd say. Right.
Okay, got an email. We were also talking about unionization and libraries, and someone said, I'm listening to your show. The Southfield School District did the exact same outsourcing of workers than the library, something like that. In this case, the school union even conceded wages to the board's requests.
You know, last week, and right to your calls, hang on there. I want to get all of these that are on hold. I was talking about that there was according to scientists, 100 million, now I'm forgetting all this. Which way was this? I think there was 100 million galaxies. No, there was 50 million galaxies.
It's a very large number.
50 million galaxies and 100 billion stars in the Milky Way alone.
Yeah.
So we had to do that mathematics. It came out to be like 21 zeros.
We did that.
And this
was one of our listeners.
And then we were saying, how in the world? So this god of the comes down to the Middle East, finds this little tribe and says, you're my chosen people. Well, now it turns
think about it.
Yeah, now it turns out, of course, that just not so far away. There's another inhabitable planet that they've, or not, they don't know it's inhabitable. They has the capacity.
Potentially habitable.
U.S. scientists find potentially habitable planet near Earth. Well, I mean, it's not exactly near.
It's orbiting in the middle of the habitable, is that right? Zone, habitable zone of the red dwarf star Gliese 581, which means it could have water on its surface. Ooh.
And speaking of religion, guess who knows the most about religion of all the different people who have different beliefs in the United States?
Who?
Atheists.
You know what? I heard something on NPR about this the other day as well, because they're the ones who have to form these arguments all the time to support their atheism.
Americans, by all measures, are a deeply religious people, but they are also deeply ignorant about their religion, or about religion in general.
Yeah.
And
basic religion test stumps many Americans. That's the New York Times headline.
That finding might surprise some, but not Dave Silverman, president of American Atheists. And he says, I've heard many times that atheists know more about religion than religious people. Atheism is an effect of that knowledge, not a lack of knowledge. I gave a Bible to my daughter. That's how you make atheists.
Oh, boy.
Said, but where were they? Oh, it said that there were these multiple choice questions. And I thought,
let's see, 53% of Protestants could not identify Martin Luther as the man who started the Protestant Reformation. 45% of Catholics did not know that their church teaches that the consecrated bread and wine and Holy Communion are not merely symbols, but actually become the body and blood of Christ. Well, God, even I know that.
What a transubstantiation.
Oh, I don't know that.
That's what it is, yeah. And I know you're not
See?
Even going to try. You're not going to try the next.
Peter.
Yeah. But I forgot how many questions there were on this. And there were multiple choice, and people Man, I can't find. But I was going to say, I could just ace these tests.
You could, multiple choice. I'm not enough of an atheist.
I'll bet you.
32 questions about the Bible.
I'm willing to bet I could get, and other religions as well.
Right.
Yeah, I'll bet you I could get 30 of the 32 correct.
Why don't you call the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life and see if they'll send you a copy.
Okay. All right. Here's John in Toledo. John.
Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hey, John. Yeah, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Yeah. My question is, I guess I hear you, you know, talking about Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney. Well, you know, we were in Iraq, we're in Afghanistan, and Obama campaigned on the fact that he would get us out of Afghanistan. Did he or did he not?
He did not. He absolutely did not. It was the opposite of what you're saying. He said there was the wrong war, that he was going to increase troops. He said this before the election, that he was going to increase the troop strength, and it was not being given the proper attention, and he was going to defeat the Taliban.
But he also did say in Iraq that he was going to pull out.
And he did. And he's stopped combat for all. So those are two promises that he kept.
Well, yeah, from what, the way I understand it, and the thing is, he campaigned on saying that we were going to pull out of this thing, and a lot of the people that are anti-war are saying that he did not keep his promises.
Well, unfortunately, they did not listen to the man closely enough. And I guess I'm not disappointed nor shocked, but I certainly was one of the reasons I never had the great enthusiasm for him that so many other people did. All right. Well, thank you for bringing that up, to be sure.
And it's easy to campaign that once you're in it, think about how it's much. This problem over there in Afghanistan is much bigger than I think he anticipated.
Yeah.
But then he made it bigger.
And the idea that the United States is somehow going to, quote, win, I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Here's Robert in Ann Arbor. Robert, your marijuana dispensary got robbed?
Yeah. What's up, Peter? This is your old friend, Rob. How you been,
Rob? Hey, Rob. How are you?
You got me through many nights when I was driving cab.
Oh,
now,
great.
One of my best friends here in Ann Arbor, their dispensary was actually on the news. Just got robbed this past week. Four gunmen went inside. They duct taped all the patients that were inside there, the employees. One of the patients got loose and stood up and knocked living snot out, I guess, one of the robbers. And one of the patrons from down in the Mongolian Barbecue, which is a restaurant, saw him going inside and notified the Ann Arbor police. And we give them all the props because they were there within seconds. And they tried to fight the police, and they weren't too successful. There was no gunfire, no gunplay. All the people got put in jail. But I wanted to comment on that one guy who was talking about the two places that got raided. Well, you know, I support, you know, because I've got a card. I've got gastric reflux, and I've got several other reasons. I just had spine surgery. Well, you know, and like you said earlier, some people are using the cards just to be able to smoke marijuana. Yeah, there are some people there, but a lot of us are doing it for the medical reasons.
Okay.
Totally,
And like, you know, it's bringing jobs to Ann Arbor. It's bringing jobs to Michigan. But what they were doing is they were just selling marijuana to undercover cops who had their forms just signed by a doctor. They didn't actually have the return check to show that, you know, after you get your 21 days after you get your return check, you're legal to go to any dispensary. They didn't have none of that. And then the people that were buying it were going out and selling it to people in the parking lots.
Sure.
So they were totally breaking the law. So I'm not going to cover their butts on that. But
wait, Rob, don't you think, though, that there are so many clinics around now that I could go in there tomorrow and have a card by Tuesday and there's not a damn thing wrong with me?
Well, actually, it depends on what doc. You know, there's doctors that are, you know, not doing the right thing. But if you go to the right doctor and you ain't got your right paperwork, you're not going to get your card.
I know people, by the way, that have asked their own doctor to prescribe marijuana for them, and the doctor said, no, I don't do that.
Really?
Yeah. And so now they have these docs set up. You go to the Metro Times, it's page after page.
At the back of the Metro Times, it's amazing.
Yeah,
advertisement.
But
yeah.
Work and all the money that's bringing to the state, you know, they charge $100 per card, and since January, they've produced 51,000 members. So you figure $100 a card, look how much money the state of Michigan has just got in that they didn't have last year.
There you go. There you go.
You know, we need to emphasize that. But anyway, Peter, I haven't talked to you in a while. I've been going through a lot. I lost my dog after 14 years.
Oh.
And I just had spine surgery. So
I just had to do that myself a week ago.
Did you? Well, he got GERD. I had a white wolf. He had GERD and his stomach put on him. And,
what's GERD?
Not GERD, I mean that bloat.
Bloat, oh yeah.
Yeah, he had bloat.
Humans get GERD. That's a stomach ailment. Gastrointestinal.
And there's so much out there that just doesn't matter, you know, that people are just blah, 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 about. But when it comes to your animals, now that's there something that matters.
All right, thank you, Rob.
Rest in peace, my little Elvis.
Appreciate that. Stephanie took the religious test and only got one wrong.
Stephanie,
are you an atheist, Stephanie? Let's see. Are you? Nope.
she just paid attention.
Do you have the test? She said, I know a lot of stuff.
That's why you're in there, girl.
Yeah.
And for anyone who says, who the hell, Stephanie, what are you talking about? Stephanie's our amazing phone screener and does a lot of producing for the show. And she puts together that podcast that so many people who are now, this is recorded tomorrow, will be listening tomorrow afternoon. Hi to you guys and gals.
And if you go to my website or go to the WRIF.com website, you can get the podcast of this show sent to you. I mean, in other words, you subscribe to it, no cost, and it'll get, when it gets put up, it'll get...
Boom, there
boom,
it is.
There it is, boom. And you listen to it, yeah. All right, here, one of our favorite callers, Maurice from Detroit. Maurice, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing, Peter and Jolene?
We're doing good. What's up?
Good, Maurice.
You know what? This government needs to be restructured legally and peacefully because they seem like they can just think they can do what they want to and don't answer to nobody.
Yeah. Well, it's the nature
of
government.
Government needs to be restructured.
Well, you know, you should listen up, and you very well may, to our first guest, who is Ted Rall, and he's got he's calling for revolution. And we start the show with a little talk about revolution, but I kind of take him to task, and then at the end of the interview, he starts talking about that violence would be acceptable. And
hey, well, I didn't realize he had it in him.
I feel kind of badly about that.
Does he kind of take you to task? Here at all?
No. I mean, I thought, wait a minute, you should never advocate violence whatsoever. That's not good at all. I mean, one of the things that this country was founded on a violent revolution, but we didn't do anything violent here. The founding fathers didn't all of a sudden start attacking the British. We said, hey, you're out of here, Mr. King. The third, right? George the third. And so then the soldiers from the empire were sent in to try to rein us back in. And then so we fought back. And that's the only time it's really legitimate, I think. You agree? Well, what?
Only way we can overthrow the government is with the backing of the military, peacefully.
Well, that's for sure.
That sounds like a tall order.
Yeah. Well, it's going to happen.
Military peacefully.
Well, in some of these countries, they have these velvet revolutions and purple revolutions and what have you, like in the former Soviet Union. And the troops, the army, just refused to clear the square, and what have you. All right, Maurice, thank you very much. But that is not necessarily necessary. There is, someone said if voting could change anything, they'd make it illegal. But right now, the structure is there to really create the basis of the change the American people want. But we always kind of wimp out a little. Yeah, I mean, it never really gets down to it.
Yes.
So the same state of affairs keeps reproducing itself. Here, by the way, one of the things that I hope doesn't happen, they are talking about taking this radioactive waste from places like Fermi 2 down in Monroe and shipping it from Canada. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Canadian radioactive waste from Canada to Sweden via the Great Lakes.
Oh.
Do you think this might be a bad idea?
Yeah, I think it's I do.
So 7 U.S. senators from the Great Lakes states, including both of our senators from from Michigan, Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow, and five other Democrats. Where in the world are the Republicans?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. They cited transportation risks of radiological releases during the shipment of these radioactive wastes over the Great Lakes. Question the wisdom of what's supposed to be happening, recycling these radioactive metals into the consumer product scrap metal recycling stream. This is another thing. We just got to stop it dead. I mean, right now we have a disaster that's sitting outside of Fermi 2 and all the rest of all the rest of these nuclear plants here and around the world. And so we have no idea how to get rid of it at all. I mean, they said every once in a while we're going to ship it into space or something like that. The Obama administration is preparing to increase the nuclear weapons. It's one of the things that can be used for it. They have all these facilities in Los Alamos and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Kansas City, Missouri. And they want to continue, they have the capacity to continue adequate stockpile surveillance and maintenance. But this never really, I mean, well, I guess it's work. Things have not blown up. But we still, we have to take, there's this nuclear waste that has to be safeguarded for a longer period of times than Homo sapiens, Cro-Magnon man. So, you know, Homo sapiens have been on the planet. I mean, and they're going to put these, like, in casks. And
yeah, and I don't care what anyone says. It's really not 100% safe at all.
No, no. So I don't mean to startle you, but they mean to kill us all.
Right.
Let's see. Actually, we were talking about Iraq. In Afghanistan, apparently, the Taliban are talking to the president of the of Afghanistan.
Karzai,
yeah.
And basically, I think what it's, they're saying is that they're trying to say, hey, can't we get along? And then maybe this fighting will end.
Yeah.
Then they won't need who? Oh, the United States.
Well, that would be good.
Yeah.
That would be absolutely
real good. Although the folks working in those corporations, the military industrial complex, don't like hearing that.
No, well, there's still, if you think about it, the threat of terrorism, which are these small cells of insanely dedicated people.
Of 0.00001 of the percentage of the folks.
So we have this, we're spending $1 trillion a year to fight a few thousand people.
Mm-hmm.
They have the capacity to do great damage.
We've seen that.
Yeah. And just this week, they were threatening to do more. They say they've actually picked out, they know these terrorists have picked out sites in Europe. They've put out warnings to Americans to, not to say don't travel there, but to be aware.
Yeah.
My sister is in Europe right now, and so you always get this kind of gunk like that. But we would go a long way. I mean, I remember this criminal mass murderer, Osama bin Laden, when he ticks off his grievances for his excuses of why he attacks civilians, is that we are attacking Muslim countries all over the world. I mean, it would be a good start, and it would defuse a lot of the anger at us if we would stop doing that. If we would get our butt out of the Middle East, get our butt out of South Asia, and take care of our problems here. Well, the reason that Ron Paul on the right and anti-war activists on the left say that we ought to dismantle all these bases around the world is, I mean, that's one of the reasons. The other thing is the enormous cost that this is, the trillions. I mean, we've spent tens of trillions of dollars since World War II as part, as I was saying early, this great transfer of wealth, what you and I and your parents, your grandparents made, and shifting it over to the government, which then distributes it in a very, very, very uneconomical way to these industries which produce the wherewithal for war. I mean, a lot of it will go to these private security companies that take enormous profits, no-bid contracts, all of this. If we wanted to take that same money, again, this transfer of wealth from us and in taxes, and then used it to employ our citizens in construction to redo our infrastructure of roads and bridges.
Yeah.
If we wanted to build
light
schools,
rail systems.
Yeah, light rail. I mean, we could take all of that money because our tax structure is not very high, right? And we could do that. But as long as we remain as our economy is based on a military industrial complex, we're going to have a deteriorating country and be involved in wars forever.
Yeah.
Can we think of anything cheery?
Yeah.
Can we think of anything cheery to end on?
Oh.
You're going to L.A. to be part of the Jackass 3
premiere. And let me say that what is his name? Help me, Stephanie. Johnny Knoxville, the creator of these. He just did a documentary about Detroit that is showing, and I don't know if it's the main art, but I'm going to go see it this week. So the guy can be serious. And when I do interview Johnny Knoxville on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock in L.A., I will be asking him probably more about that documentary about Detroit, and I'm sure he's going to give me a little extra time because I'm a Detroiter.
And then is he from Detroit? No.
I don't think so.
No. But you were going to try to get back here in time for the show, but I convinced you that the time deal, you'll never make it.
Yeah, I don't think so. Well, maybe there will be a miracle.
Well, you actually would have to, in order to get back here, you would have to leave there at 2 p.m. West Coast time.
West Coast time. I think I can do that.
Then that's 8 hours, though. You need 8 hours. You need 5 hours for the flight
and three
hours for the time difference.
I'm going to try to make it back here because I really want to talk about that, especially the documentary.
But you know what? Everybody, and I'm not even sure, Jackass movies, it's not fiction. It's actually stunts. These guys are...
Yes.
You told me one. You don't want to tell that one on the air.
Well, it involved the laxatives in the toilet store.
Okay.
That was from number one. I haven't even seen number two. I don't, you know,
And these guys are, like, hurting themselves and all that?
They just do some really crazy stuff.
And
yeah.
It's like...
You couldn't take it, Peter.
No.
You shut it off after 5 minutes. Why they're sending me, I think, is a riot. Maybe they think I have a good sense of humor.
All right, so I may be flying solo, or we'll get Jalene back here next week. What are you looking at?
Oh, it's just, hey, to the Michigan State Police.
Oh, all right.
Hi. How are you?
They haven't walked in the door. We have big windows, and they were just circling the building. Hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
All right, we're out of here. Stephanie, thank you so much. Thanks to all of you for listening and calling. And a minimum, I'll be back. Hopefully, we'll get Jalene as well.
I hope so.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call. Right after this.
That was another credit card company calling. Things have not been good the last couple years, but I'm really hoping they turn around.
I felt the same way, but I called Bankruptcy Rescue 2 years ago, and now my credit is great. I just got a car at a low interest rate, and soon I'll be getting the house that I've been dreaming of.
Don't let the fear of not knowing what to expect after bankruptcy stop you from making the decision that's best for your family. Bankruptcy Rescue will help rebuild your credit. We provide a free analysis of your individual situation and help you make the right decision. Go to MyBankruptcyRescue.com to get information, or call 888-55-RESCUE for an appointment.
Bankruptcy Rescue helped me rebuild my credit fast. Filing bankruptcy was the best thing I ever did. Visit MyBankruptcyRescue.com or call 888-55-RESCUE today.
Bankruptcy Rescue is a debt relief agency. We help people file for bankruptcy relief under the bankruptcy code. You don't have any more time to waste. Bankruptcy Rescue. Saving families through bankruptcy. We know you love to save money. That's why we know you'll love MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Each weekday, MotorCityDailyDeal.com sends an unbelievable deal right to your inbox. We're working with local businesses to make sure these deals save you 50 to 85% off. Restaurants, salons, spas, events, and more. You get incredible deals from great local businesses like these.
O'Toole's in Waterford, Haunted Blake's in Armada, Wine Sink in Northville, Wonderground Magic in Clawson, and Gator Jake's in Sterling Heights.
And these deals are so good, they're only available for 24 hours. That's right, just 24 hours, then they're gone. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's your new local way to save on all the cool things you love to eat, see, and do. Log on, sign up, and save with MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Place your bids now during the Motor City Steals and Deals Fall into Savings Online Auction. Save more than 50% off retail prices.
That's right, more than 50% off artwork by Thomas Kincaid and Peter Max. A Yamaha ATV, hockey training, spa packages, wine tastings, tanning, and more.
What are you waiting for?
What are you waiting for?
Log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and place your bids now. That's MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
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 Tom.
Ever see The Hangover? Well, that's nothing.
Oh, dear Lord.
101 WRIF is taking over the Vegas Strip for Halloween, and you're coming with us.
Is it awesome?
It's pretty awesome.
And Carlini, Meltdown, and Screamin' Scott will be your tour guides as they broadcast live poolside.
Oh, God. We're all in trouble.
Nice.
3 nights of debauchery, hanging with Godsmack, 3 days grace, Buckcherry, and Drowning Pool. Plus, a VIP-only poolside performance from Nickelback at Mandalay Bay.
I think it's safe to say that our luck has officially turned around, guys.
Remember, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Unless, of course, it's broadcast live back to Detroit for all to hear, then you're on your own.
We don't have to tell everything. We can leave out the stuff about me marrying a hooker.
The Rift's Sin City Takeover. Details at WRIF.com. Presented by Southern Comfort Lime. The taste that swept the nation. Now available in a bottle. So go lime, just chill, serve, and enjoy responsibly. And 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, long ago, there used to be this awful congressional subcommittee called the House Un-American Activities Committee, or the Committee on Un-American Activities. And that was really something bad you could say about someone, that they were un-American, whatever the hell that meant. Back then, it pretty much meant you were for civil rights, you were for peace, you were for labor unions and, you know, civil liberties, stuff like that. But what has come into the modern era is the phrase anti-American. And to say someone is anti-American, wow, that's, that's really shoving someone to the margins. So it struck me, and struck me hard immediately, when I saw a book called The Anti-American Manifesto, and even more so that it was done by syndicated political cartoonist Ted Rall. He has been a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. He's an opinion columnist. He's a graphic novelist. He's been a war correspondent. He's been in Afghanistan. His work appears in hundreds of publications, including the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. And now we got to find out, what does this mean, the Anti-American Manifesto? Ted Rall, thanks for joining me. You're in New York City, huh?
Yes, I am, Peter.
Yeah, so that sounds pretty bad. The anti-American manifesto. What's up with that? I mean, or was it to get everyone's attention, like it got mine?
Mainly, that was the main point. But originally, the book was going to be called the Post-American Manifesto, and the rationale for that was that what I was arguing was that the right wing was going to take over a collapsing United States if the left did not. So the left should do it first. And then, you know, one night I was up late and I said, well, you know, people like Sean Hannity are going to call this anti-American. And I thought, why not just embrace that? And it'll be very tongue-in-cheek. It's what Abby Hoffman would have done. It'll attract a lot more attention. And after all, it's an important message that I have. So the more eyeballs on it, the better. So I went ahead and embraced it. What's really funny is that the right has not said a word.
Well, you're just launching it in a way, right? You're on a book tour and everything like that. And it'll sort of depend on how much traction it gets. But given your prominence as both a syndicated political cartoonist and opinion columnist and appearing in so many papers, I suspect you're probably going to come under, let's say, the microscope and not under the gun with those whack jobs.
Never know, and but the book was announced at least 6 months ago by my publisher. It's a mainstream publisher. You could order it on Amazon. I mean, it's not a secret. I've been promoting it on my website. A lot of right wingers read my website, so they know it exists. In fact, a copy has been messengered over to Glenn Beck's producer, so I know they know.
Well, and you can go to Ted Rall's website. It's Ted Rall, RALL.com, and the wonderful publisher is Seven Stories Press. You can go to sevenstories.com. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. Well, this country's in a lot of trouble right now, so maybe, Ted Rall, you ought to flesh out a little more what you mean. Let's get rid of the anti-American thing, because like un-American, it's not even ever clear what the people that level that charge even mean. So it's a manifesto for revolution. And again, revolution can mean anything from new hair coloring to the American Revolution to some commie revolution, people would think. Where are you at with all this?
Well, in a way, where I am doesn't really matter. What really matters is creating the space in people's minds to think outside of the box of the two-party system, the Democrats versus the Republicans. I mean, politics in the United States today boils down to D versus R, and it happens every 2 to 4 years on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, and it takes place occasionally. There might be some little rally that you take the bus to Washington and march around peacefully and then go home. That's not how politics unfolds in other countries. You know, for instance, after the 2000 election was stolen, if that same event had occurred in East Timor or Ghana, you can be sure that, or for that matter, France or Italy, you can be sure that people would have headed into the streets and things would have gotten a little bit perkier, shall we say.
Yeah, it's amazing that Al Gore, who won the election, won the popular vote, and like you, Ted Rall, I think it was actually stolen, old Chicago style, that that Al Gore didn't call for nationwide protest demonstrations the way, for instance, the winner of the Mexican Revolution, or, I'm sorry, the Mexican election right around that time called for his supporters to occupy Mexico City.
He should have. In my view, Al Gore made the wrong decision. It was an unpatriotic decision, one that denied American democracy its last chance to redeem itself. And what he did was wrong. And I would suspect he probably knows that now. But that whole, that, in fact, the stolen election is just sort of part of the narrative of, that I set out in the book about the five major events, or you could say four and a half major events, that have really marked the decline of America in a way that proves to the vast majority of Americans that the system is broken. So the so for me, it's really a seminal event.
Well, you talk about your book, The Anti-American Manifesto, as a call for revolution, where most people would say what we need is a reform. Most people think of revolution as having a number of dicey aspects to it. Could wind up in violence, could wind up with an authoritarian government, could wind up with an economic system that a lot of us wouldn't like. What are we after here?
Revolution is something that you should only undertake when you're dealing with a very desperate situation and you don't see any other way out. You know, we obviously know the history of the French Revolution, leaving the terror out of it. You know, the French did not want Napoleon to come in and establish a dictatorship. Certainly the Russians didn't revolt in order to get Stalin 10 years later, but that's what they got. So revolutions absolutely can and often do go very badly, and they're not to be undertaken lightly. I do think, however, that the situation is so radically broken and so radically severe that there's no other way to look at it. I mean, if you look at the system's complete inability to respond to the greatest crisis it has faced in the last 100 years, the economic meltdown that has led to millions of foreclosures, real unemployment rate that's over 20%, and meanwhile, even while this is going on, they're pouring money into the pockets of bankers instead of people who, in order to increase social stability, they're still pouring billions of dollars into military contractors' pockets to keep the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq going on and keep 650,000 men under arms around the world and about 2 to 3 million military contractor employees. You know, they're literally insane and unable to save themselves. Now, you know, you mentioned reform. Reform is obviously always the superior option. It's more peaceful. It's cheaper. It's easier. It's cheaper in terms of lives. It's cheaper in every way. It's better if you can carry it off. But if you look at recent history, or I should say the history of revolution in the last 200 years, you will notice an interesting irony, which is that revolution always happens under the rule of liberal reformers. Mikhail Gorbachev was the liberal reformer who tried to save Soviet communism, and yet he was overthrown. And Louis XVI was a liberal reformer in France, and he was overthrown. And George III was a liberal reformer during the American Revolution, yet we cut him loose, and so on. And you know, historians have always viewed that as an irony, but I've been thinking about it a lot, and I think actually it's a cause of revolution. Once you get someone like a Gorbachev or an Obama to come in, and you realize that this is pretty much the best that you're going to get. You know, I think Barack Obama is the best president that this country, this system, can cough up. You're not going to get anyone smarter. You're not going to get a better cabinet. You're not going to get someone further to the left. This is it. This is the best they've got. And yet, he's not good enough. And when people look at that situation and say, well, the best the system has isn't good enough, you know, it's kind of like when you take your car in for repair and it's working great, but it still can't climb the hill.
Sure.
You know, you're like, it's time to get a new car.
Yeah.
And that's what we've got now.
If you go for the Roman analogy, and it's not that Obama is dictatorial, but he could be at least a Caesar figure, but in waiting in the wings is Nero and Caligula, you know, in terms of some of these other people that say they're posing alternatives. But let me just look at reform and revolution. People will only go to a revolutionary stance when all possibility of reform within the current system is no longer possible. Whereas now we could do anything. I mean, we could elect representatives that would pass all the laws that we want and reform everything that you said, but it's just not in the cards.
Yeah. Well, could we? Could we really? I mean, can a Dennis Kucinich be replicated? Can there be? Can we have a House and a Senate full of Ralph Naders?
Or John Conyers? Yeah. Well, there's something. There's the inertia of the old system. In many ways, Venezuela is a good example. You had the liberals and the conservatives that year after year would trade who was in power, and they would denounce each other furiously, and you know, the conservative party was a little worse than the liberal party in Venezuela, and then suddenly it broke through with Chavez, although again I don't know that that not advocating that necessarily as the form for things. Well, but there's a political blackmail here, and we've talked about it on some of the talk shows that I do, and that is that they say, well, if we listen to Ted Rall and the whole game is rigged and it's impossible to have real reform, why should I vote? And because, you know, the people on the left, the rank and file, are highly ethical people. And when they see the people they thought were going to bring about real change don't live up to their promises, they stay home. Whereas the right wing, they couldn't care less what kind of monstrous crimes these people have been involved in, or, you know, what kind of hypocrisy, or, you know, we could spend the rest of the time just detailing the pedigree of the people that are running on the Republican right. So there's this there's this political blackmail, though. Well, gee, if you don't vote for the Democrats, you don't want the Republicans to get in, do you?
Yeah, it's like a cartoon I drew recently with a woman on election day asking her boyfriend to go to the polls while he's at home playing a Wii instead. And she says, if you don't like the Democratic Party's Republican Party policies, think how much you'll hate the Republican Party's Republican policies.
Right.
And, I'm tired of this argument coming from the Democrats that the left has to wait. Every 2 to 4 years, we're told, like, this is not the time to rock the boat. If we don't vote Democratic and pull behind these people, the Republicans are going to make things even worse. They're going to roll back all the gains of the civil rights movement and the Great Society, as if they already hadn't done that. And, but hey, later on, when we have our chance, we're going to do all that. Well, you know, here's my question to those people. I would say, 2008, we got our chance. I mean, you have a Democratic president, you have a mandate for change, you've got control of the Senate, you've got control, you're 59 seats in the Senate, you've got overwhelming control of the House of Representatives, vast majority of state houses are under Democratic control, firmly. What more do you want? Like, you know, it's like someone saving for a rainy day.
Hmm.
It's raining. And if there was ever a time that, you know, that Obama could have passed real liberal reforms in the economic system and otherwise, it would have been in 2009 when he came in the middle of an economic meltdown and people are desperate for change. The economy was bleeding 600,000 jobs a month. But he didn't do it. He gave $1.4 trillion to Citicorp and these other companies and AIG that they used to give their executives raises and redecorate their corporate men's rooms. It's the thing about the Republican Party is they treat their right a lot better. They don't have to wait so long. They do abuse their conservatives, and they do take them for granted. But every 8 to 12 or to 16 years, they get paid off. You know, when do we get paid off? I'm 47 years old. I'm still waiting.
Ted Rawl is my guest. Ted Rawl is the syndicated political cartoonist and opinion columnist, and his new book is the provocatively titled The Anti-American Manifesto, saying we're pretty much at a dead end. We've got to make some real leaps politically and in our consciousness. Tell us a little about your cartoon work, and it's syndicated, appears in a considerable number of publications, correct?
Yeah, just shy of 100. It used to be like 140, but you know, the print media has melted down. There's fewer cartoons running in newspapers, and I'm also so I do 3 a week for them. I do a cartoon for the LA Times every week. I did some cartoons for the LA Times when I was in Afghanistan, and I do books. This is my 16th book, so you know, I have like a lot of Americans, I have 3 jobs.
That's good. And you mentioned Afghanistan. How in the world does a political cartoonist wind up in Afghanistan?
Well, he asks for the help of his cartooning fans. I went to a website called Kickstarter.com and asked people to put up some money to send me back to Afghanistan. I've been in 2001, and I wrote a book about it to find out what the hell was going on. And because you know, there's just a sense, I think widespread sense, that from watching the news that you really, you know, there's a lot of coverage, but there's no news. You can't really tell what's going on there from all these embedded reporters. When I got there, it was kind of amazing to find out that I and my 2 fellow cartoonists who went with me, Matt Boris and Stephen Cloud, might have been the only unembedded reporters of any kind in the entire country. And people just didn't know what to make of us.
Let me just interrupt you 1 second. Tell us, I mean, how does one get to Kabul? I mean, you just get on a plane?
You can fly, and probably that's what we should have done. I was relying on old information about, you know, the Kabul airport being dangerous. That's not really true anymore. So we probably should have just flown in. But we went in overland from Tajikistan, and we drove in to the north to through Talakan and Mazar-e-Sharif and Kunduz and places like that. Kunduz is under Taliban controlled, so is Talakan. So we went through there, and then then we drove down to Kabul, and then we sort of hopscotched across the country. We went pretty much everywhere we could go. The country has been effectively bifurcated by the Taliban. They control about 85% to 90% of the country, and the United States isn't really lifting a finger to provide security. So there's not really any, it's interesting, there's not really much of a military presence anywhere outside of the eastern border near Pakistan.
There's sort of a zen quality to it. We're in Afghanistan because we're in Afghanistan. We're just there now, right? I mean, there's no real reason for it. Huh? What?
It's very Douglas Adams, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very strange. You know, it's like it becomes its own its own raison d'être, and that's what it. I couldn't really understand the whole time I was there why the U.S. was not interested in providing security to Afghans, because it seems to me that's the most important job there. That's what Afghans want us to do, and it would be pretty easy. You know, I mean, when you see by Predator drone, you know, 400 guys on dirt bikes converging on a gas truck on a highway, you're pretty sure what they're up to.
Yeah.
But instead, we're not even trying to do that.
Any solution there? It's another one of those damned if we do, damned if we don't things that we manage to get ourselves into. And I usually try to be real particular about pronouns. And we're in there, in all of us, not only because of taxes, but because the results there, what's going on, and now this this beginning military exercises against Kandahar. It's all of our responsibility. What?
Yeah, I go both ways on that. You know, in the Anti-American Manifesto, I in the very first page, I explain that I don't use "we" to talk about the U.S. government because it's no longer our government; it's gone rogue. But in another sense, it's very true that obviously no one can rule without the tacit consent of the governed, and we are tolerating this. We are paying our taxes. We're not even protesting, so we don't have much to complain about. And I think in terms of the solution, well, the solution is to get the hell out. We're not going to win over there. I mean, let me put it this way. I don't think if I were running the war, I could win. I think I could just make it less bad.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to win. No country has successfully occupied another one since the 1900s. Since the 1800s. And so it's not going to start happening here, not in this country, where the only thing that unites them is their hatred of invaders. It's just not going to happen.
Well, it's to some extent, you're echoing what was said about Iraq, and that is that we could never defeat this insurgency, and by spending hundreds of millions of dollars buying some people off and also putting tens of thousands of more troops in there, we actually quieted the insurgents, certainly not gone, and this is ongoing. American soldiers are still dying there every week. But, put another 50,000 troops in there and, buy off more people. Petraeus spending $100 million to buy electrical generators for people in the Kandahar region. You know where they need them? Detroit, right? But, for real. I mean, people in Detroit, there's neighborhoods where 50% of the people don't have their utilities on.
Well, the thing is that, you can, in a counterinsurgency campaign, you can buy peace and quiet. It's expensive. And the people there, however, will wait you out. They live there. Insurgents aren't professional full-time insurgents. These are taxi drivers and farmers and unemployed people. And at night, they go out and set an IED, and then they sneak back home. So they're the people. And so if it takes them 50 years, they'll wait us out because eventually it just becomes too expensive, or we start to get, relax and think, everything's fine. We can come home now. But believe me, we did not win in Iraq. We're not going to win in Iraq.
Hmm. What shape, what face would your revolution take?
Well, in the book, I kick that can down the road, and I do it intentionally because I think there's things that there are aspects of revolution that should even appeal to people on the right, and certainly for an alliance of convenience. I did not want to set forth a political program or a list of tactics in this book because this book isn't about that. This book is about getting people to think outside of the box of the two-party system, to understand that there are other ways of government, other methods of government, and that we can have those other methods of government here. And so that's what, it took me 288 pages to make that case. And if I'd had to add a political program to it and how the revolution is going to unfold, which I could not possibly predict, because once you release all these pent-up forces in a country where 88% of eligible voters don't vote, we don't really know who Americans are politically. We have no idea because they don't vote. And I think they don't vote because they don't see any candidates or political parties that care about them at all.
Why do you say 88%?
Yeah, of eligible voters, not registered. We always talk about registered voters. But if you talk about, people who are U.S. citizens over the age of 18 and not convicted of a felony, 88% in an average election.
They just had an election, a primary in Detroit, and 18% of the eligible voters voted.
So that's probably about 7%.
Well, we're all, people are, from civics class on, are always condemnatory of the people that don't take part in the electoral system, but it really bespeaks, I think, a great sense that the vote just won't change things very much.
Yeah, well, I think it's up to the politicians to make themselves appealing to the voters, not the other way around. Nobody, if you were an executive at Coke and nobody was drinking Coke anymore, you wouldn't say, God, Americans suck. They don't drink Coke. You'd say, we should make this taste better. And that's exactly what we've got here. It's hilarious. People are apathetic. It's your duty to vote. What for? The Democrats and the Republicans have been equally screwing the American people for years. And I don't think it makes any difference who's going to win in November.
Well, I think that's something for a whole show. I think the people that will probably most heed your call, the listeners, will be Democrats, liberals, people on the left. There's nothing that can shake the confidence of conservative voters in their right-wing candidates. But real quickly, I should let you answer that, but I see we're almost out of time. This provocative title, as I've called it, the Anti-American Manifesto, saying things have reached to a point we ought to be thinking about revolution. And you said the right-wing like talk show hosts and all, haven't responded at all. When you've been around the country, I mean, you're a very well-known political cartoonist. You're called the most controversial cartoonist in America by Cartoon.com. What's been the people that have come out to see you? What have they thought?
Well, so far it's been mostly a love-in, you know, which is, I guess, to be expected. It's early on, so the people who come are people who like me and my work. Presumably that'll change as this process changes, and I hope it does. I look forward to that debate and that discussion. I like a lively debate, but in terms of the book, the turnout, I mean, I guess in terms of conflict, ironically, the conflict has been mainly from liberals who are opposed to the idea of ever using violence as part of the tools of resistance. Basically since the 1960s, there has been sort of this new religion on the American left that all resistance must be peaceful and nonviolent. And there was a book that appeared a few years ago called How Nonviolence Protects the State that I highly recommend.
We are out of time. I didn't even know you were going there. I would have spent a whole lot of time on this. So you're going to have to pick up Ted Rawl's book. It's called The Anti-American Manifesto. I guess they're not going to charge him with being anti-American when he says that right in the title. You can go to Ted Rawl, RALL.com, and you can also go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and there'll be a link. Ted, thanks so much for being on the show, and we'll look for your cartoons.
Thanks, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Mid-Michigan, if you've had credit problems and are in need of an auto loan, Lasco Ford in Fenton has good news. You're approved. Right now, you can go to LascoFord.com and get pre-approved. And if Lasco Ford can't get you an auto loan, they'll pay you $1,000 in cash. Lasco Ford has national lenders that will offer auto loans at affordable payments, like a 2008 Ford Fusion for only $149 a month. Lasco Ford also has programs for customers that may have had foreclosures, loan modifications, or repossessions in the past. And this month at Lasco Ford, you can choose from zero down or deferred payments for up to 6 months. If you have had credit problems or have been turned down by another dealer, call Lasco Ford today and get approved. If you're turned down, they'll pay you $1,000 cash. You can visit LascoFord.com to get pre-approved 24 hours a day at Lasco Ford. Open until 8 p.m. weekdays, Saturday 9 to 5, or visit LascoFord.com.
It's been 40 years in the making.
Like, wow, man. You gotta check out this new album from Jimmy.
And from back in the day.
To the here and now. People like WRIF Screen and Scott. Have gone on to have successful careers in broadcasting and beyond with the help of Spex Howard School of Media Arts. Celebrating their 40th anniversary, Spex has helped launch over 12,000 grads into the fantastic worlds of radio, TV, and today, movies. In fact, the radio, video, and film program is the cornerstone of Spex Howard School of Media Arts. I'm a graduate, too, although I don't want to say how far back for selfish reasons. But hey, you can get intensive, hands-on, real-world training for a career in radio, television, video production, or film. You, too, can become a part of Spex Howard's history. But first things first, don't just take my word for it. Discover all that Specs has to offer for yourself with a free no-obligation tour. Call 866-61-SPECS or check out SpecsHoward.edu. And like they say,
make your life anything but ordinary.
We know you love to save money. That's why we know you'll love MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Each weekday, MotorCityDailyDeal.com sends an unbelievable deal right to your inbox. We're working with local businesses to make sure these deals save you 50 to 85% off. Restaurants, salons, spas, events, and more. You get incredible deals from great local businesses like these.
O'Toole's in Waterford, Haunted Blake's in Armada, Wine Sink in Northville, Wonderground Magic in Clawson, and Gator Jake's in Sterling Heights.
And these deals are so good, they're only available for 24 hours. That's right, just 24 hours, then they're gone. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's your new local way to save on all the cool things you love to eat, see, and do. Log on, sign up, and save with MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com. MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
Are you interested in a broadcast or media-related career? Want to get ahead of the round?
broadcast, be more marketable, more innovative? Attend the 2010 Broadcasting Career Builder Conference, BCBC, and learn how to be successful. BCBC features great sessions, a career fair, and lunch, all on Friday, October 29th at Lansing Community College's West Campus. Visit www.mybcbc.com for rates and information. That's mybcbc.com. This message sponsored by the MAB and MAB Foundation.
Elise, come on, it's game day. You've got all weekend to study.
Jen, this has nothing to do with studying. I've got to work. The way the economy is, I figure I'll be working for the next century just to pay off these student loans.
Well, you know...
I know. You joined the National Guard, so your college is completely paid for. Yes, you've mentioned it a couple thousand times.
The National Guard Scholarship covers up to 100% of your tuition. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Michigan National Guard, aired by the Michigan Association of Broadcasters and this station.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Boy, every city has such a history. And most of us don't know much about our own history of the city, except in broad terms, perhaps more, sometimes people, a couple of weeks. That's where our historic memory goes back. But history is fascinating to me, and I think to many of you as well. It's one of the reasons you listen to this broadcast, because we talk about our history so much, our country and our state and our community. And there's a book that just come my way that is absolutely fascinating, that contains so much, it is actually challenging, extraordinarily challenging to me, to how are we going to even get a broad overview of this into a 25-minute broadcast. With me is one of the authors, co-authors, three people put this incredible history together. The book is called The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman. Now, that's the subject of this book, but the subtitle is Ernie Goodman, Detroit and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights. And Ernie Goodman was an incredible attorney. In fact, one of the nation's prominent defense attorneys. He worked for workers and militant poor throughout his 50-year history, and it contains almost the history of the middle section of the last century. Joining me in the studio is Steve Babson. He's one of the co-authors, along with Dave Riddle and David Elsula, two activists in the labor movement for many years. Steve Babson has published six books, including Working Detroit, The Making of a Union Town, and also Lean Working, Empowerment and Exploitation in the Global Auto Industry. He's currently the newsletter editor for Local 675 of the American Association of University Professors, American Federation of Teachers. And that represents the faculty and academic staff at Wayne State University. Steve Babson, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thanks. A pleasure to be here.
What an incredible book. What an incredible man. I mean, how do we place Ernie Goodman? I'm going to leave it to you to begin this discussion. And this seems like almost an impossible question. Who was Ernie Goodman?
Well, Ernie Goodman was a man who stood at the forefront of some of the most dramatic struggles for social justice over the last century. And so the story of Ernie is really the story not only of Detroit, but the story of those long campaigns for civil rights, for labor rights, and a whole range of issues, starting from the 1930s when he became a labor lawyer and was actively involved in the rise of the UAW and the sit-down strikes and that whole dramatic story. And from there, in the 1940s, was very prominent as a civil rights lawyer in the early years of the civil rights movement, when the labor movement and the civil rights movement were really growing out of the same roots here in this city. And from there to the Red Scare of the 1950s, when only a few were willing to stand up for the issues of the Bill of Rights and First Amendment rights and the right to dissent from a domineering majority. And he went through the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Smith Act trials, and that prolonged sort of winter time in his career when he was isolated and one of a few stalwarts who stood up for the Bill of Rights and was vindicated towards the end of that decade, and then was able to, in effect, reinvent himself as a participant in the New Left and the civil rights movement of the early 1960s, the anti-war movement, opposing the war in Vietnam, and then the Black Power movement. He became prominent. His last major case was in the mid-1970s when he defended the Attica prison rebels. So it is an amazing story, and what I really loved about writing this book and working on it was that as an historian, you sometimes become really accustomed to these sort of vertical chimneys of categories, so that you either study the civil rights movement, or you study economic history, or you study foreign policy, or you study the labor. And what was great about writing a biography was that you actually, through the lived experience of the protagonist in this case, you see how these are actually all connected and often simultaneous and at least successive events, so that it's a larger story seen through the eyes of this one unique individual who was not just a lawyer but also an organizer, really.
Ernie Goodman is who we're talking about. The book is The Color of Law, and aptly published by the Wayne State University Press, part of its Great Lakes Books series. And you can go to erniegoodman.com. A lot of the events around the book are there. And also my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, will have a link as well. Steve Babson, let's go right to Ernie Goodman's birth. He lived quite a long life, into his 90s. He was born in what year?
He was born in 1906, and we often played with the idea of calling the book 20th Century Man, because he lived in every decade of the 20th century. And so it's a remarkable trajectory in terms of what's happening to Detroit in those years. The dramatic rise and fall of this city is one he experienced as a teenager and a young lawyer in the 1920s, when he, by the way, wasn't particularly inclined towards radical politics at all. He aspired to be a corporate lawyer, but found that a hard go, in part because of the anti-Semitism that was so dominant at that time, and which severely restricted the professional reach for lawyers and doctors and whatnot of Jewish heritage. And then obviously difficulties in 1929 and the years following, when it was very difficult for any lawyer to make their way and find business opportunities. And he finally had the kind of conversion crisis that millions of people had during the Great Depression, when all of the promises of upward mobility and reward for, you know, striving and hard work turned out to be empty promises that meant nothing when unemployment.
Those days are behind us.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the other interesting dimension of this, is just noting the many, many moments in Ernie's life that resonate with the issues that are still with us today, whether it's immigrant history, whether it's the history of the national security state, whether it's labor rights and civil rights. All of those issues are still with us, different in some of the details, but still fundamentally these are the kinds of issues that people are still trying to come to grips with.
And Ernie Goodman, Detroit lawyer and involved in all of the major struggles for civil rights, civil liberties, labor during the 20th century, and born in Detroit in 1906 into this Jewish section of Detroit, which then was Hastings Street, which produced any number of very prominent people, quite a few lawyers, quite a few radicals.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a dimension of Detroit history that, of course, has been literally paved over. It's where I-375 and I-75 are. And the portion of Hastings Street that was just north of Gratiot, on either side of Gratiot, really straddling Gratiot, was the Jewish ghetto. And very difficult to find accommodations, housing outside of that area. There were prevailing restrictions on, basically in the real estate industry, on who would sell homes to a Jewish family. But over time, that community slowly migrated sort of north and west, eventually arriving at 12th Street, and then continuing north and west into Southfield. And so part of the story is the story of Ernie's, in effect, learning what it felt like to suffer a thoroughgoing discrimination. And it accounts a lot for his later ability to empathize with and identify with the struggle for black civil rights.
Steve Babson, in The Color of Law that you wrote with Dave Riddle and David Alsala, about Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the struggle for labor and civil rights, as you say, he's a prism through which you can see so many of the events of Detroit history, and actually U.S. history as well. We're fortunate to have someone like him, because so many of these stories, I was thinking about the unemployed council of 1931 and how there's nothing like that now. People mostly experience unemployment as great personal sadness and tragedy and try to get out of it all by themselves. But tell us a little about 1931, what Detroit was like, and the role that Ernie Goodman played.
Well, at that point, this was 31 would be before, actually, Ernie had his conversion to socialism, to the labor movement, to the civil rights movement. In 1931, he was still a striving wannabe corporate lawyer who was finding it very difficult to make his way, particularly in a city where the unemployment rate is only estimated because the government did not make an effort to collect unemployment statistics at that time. But the estimates are that in Detroit, roughly 45 to 55% of the population was unemployed. And the city hospital reported at least 4 to 5 cadavers that were brought to their doorstep every morning. People who had been found dead in the streets, dying of exposure. And a city which in that regard certainly evokes what we understand about what's going on today in the city of Detroit, but in a different circumstance, because it was a very wealthy city until 1929, and people are surrounded by the most advanced production technology on the planet, and yet it's largely the factories are empty. And so there was an acute sense of the injustice of this, that here was the way to produce wealth, and yet it was lying fallow. As capitalism basically had proven to be a complete failure at that moment. And that's what spurred Ernie and many others to eventually change their identification with the social and become aligned with a social movement that would seek a transformation of that economy.
Tell us just briefly about the unemployed march to the gates of the Ford Rouge plant and the results of that.
It was 1932, and the unemployed councils, which had begun organizing several years beforehand, largely organized by members of the Communist Party or the Socialist Party. There was, at this time, remember, no unemployment insurance, no welfare safety net, no Social Security, no nothing. When you were unemployed, you were basically pitched out into the street and would have to fend for yourself. And the only way people felt that they could do so would be by coming together in these neighborhood organizations called the unemployed councils, often led, as I said, by communists, but overwhelmingly made up of workers, whether they were Republicans, Democrats, apolitical, what have you, because they were desperate. And in 1932, they marched on the Ford plant in response to Henry Ford's somewhat delirious claim that there really was no crisis to speak of, that people could find work if they simply hitched up their belt and made the effort. Obviously, this was a real misrepresentation of what was going on, because after all, his own factory had largely been shut down. He had laid off three quarters of his workforce. So they marched on the Ford plant in Dearborn, about 3,000, asking Ford for jobs, basically. They were going to call his bluff. If he was insisting there was work available, they were going to march to Dearborn and take him up on his offer and demand also that he support some of the foods, kitchens and soup lines that were supporting the unemployed. And instead, they were met by gunfire. Four were killed immediately. A fifth man died of his wounds later. And four of them, are buried in Woodmere Cemetery. Local 600, many years later, actually commemorated their memory by placing gravestones in what were otherwise unmarked graves. But it was, in effect, the start of a recognition of just how severe the crisis was and the social forces that were now at loggerheads over which way to go.
Now, how would Ernie Goodman, for instance, get information about this that he would be sympathetic to? Certainly the big papers, the Detroit Times, the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, all characterized this as a communist riot to which the Dearborn police responded. What was it that Ernie Goodman, the attorney and the subject of the book, The Color of Law, where did he get his information? I guess, because that's what people always ask today. Where do we find out stuff? I mean, we got the internet today, not true then.
Right, and it's an excellent question, because it also brings to mind the fact that the newspapers varied in their coverage. The initial reporting, as you say, was a hysterical exaggeration of a communist threat and basically blaming the victims, many of whom, by the way, there were roughly 50 wounded, and many of them were handcuffed to their beds in the hospital. But some of the reporters, particularly the Detroit Times, the old Hearst paper, actually did a much better job at subsequently following up and reporting on the actual circumstances of that march in which the police just opened fire on an unarmed crowd. And by the way, also Ford guards firing through the gates on Miller Road there. And in addition to that, Ernie just happened to be working downtown. He had an office, and there was a newsstand on Griswold downtown that sold copies of the New Masses. And Ernie started picking it up, like a lot of people, curious to see if there was some way of comprehending what was going on. So he started reading.
Yeah, the communist paper.
Right. Yeah. The New Masses was published by the Communist Party. And as he recalled it years later, he didn't always agree with what he was reading, but increasingly he found it much more persuasive than the denial that was so frequently the menu offered by the established press.
Well, we are talking about the book, The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights. Steve Babson is my guest, and he's written the book along with Dave Riddle and David Elsala. And I can see we have now about 10 minutes left, and we haven't even gotten Ernie Goodman into action. And that's why there is a 500-page book. The book is extraordinary. Steve Babson, let me leave it to you. Where do you want to go? How can we tell people about Ernie Goodman that exemplifies the man and his work?
Well, let me jump ahead a couple decades. I'll just say in passing that he met a guy named Maury Sugar, a lawyer who was very much a man of the left, and it was his mentoring that brought Ernie into a new approach to lawyering and an identification with the people and an aspiration to serve them. He became actually worked with Maury Sugar as an associate general counsel to the UAW for many years. But then with the onset of the Red Scare, there was a falling out, and Ernie was banished along with others of his political inclination, that is, they were left-wingers, to the margins of society, in effect. And the National Lawyers Guild, the organization that was formed to support and promote the ideas of a progressive legal practice, itself went into decline. It was attacked as a subversive organization. Its membership went from 5,000 to less than 500. And many lawyers found, no matter how much they might have personally identified with progressive politics and the need for fundamental social change, it just was a killing matter to be associated with the guild and associated with the left. Ernie was one of those who kept struggling and fighting to defend those principles.
This is the late 1940s and into the 1950s.
By the late 1950s, it is the Lawyers Guild, led by Ernie Goodman, who had weathered this storm of the Red Scare and the repeated rounds of prosecutions and persecutions, to identify the next big struggle in American history, and that was, of course, the emerging civil rights movement. And keep in mind that at that time, the American Bar Association was a whites-only organization dominated by corporate lawyers who denounced the early civil rights movement, as many did, as a communist plot, because after all, it was calling for affirmative action and it was calling for civil rights for blacks. And this was regarded by many in a society that was still basically wedded to the ideas of white supremacy. This was regarded as subversive. And Ernie, in contrast to the American Bar Association, devoted the remaining resources of the guild and basically regarded this was the only way the guild could possibly survive and have a role in the future, was to identify with that early civil rights movement. So many of your listeners, I should say, may be aware of an event called Freedom Summer in 1964, which was one of the decisive battles in Mississippi over voting rights. And at the end of that summer of struggle with young students going south to support the effort of African Americans to register to vote, in other words, assert a right that was guaranteed under the Bill of Rights but denied under the Jim Crow laws of Mississippi and elsewhere. At the end of that summer, 5 were dead and many hundreds arrested, 900 arrests, in fact, and no one to defend them in the South except for the National Lawyers Guild. Ernie led the Lawyers Guild into a prolonged campaign to support that civil rights struggle in the South. At the same time, by the way, he was also active in the civil rights struggle in the North, and saw it as important to recognize that it wasn't just a regional issue. This was a national issue and a need for national legislation and a national movement. And it was the Guild, led by Goodman, who shamed the American Bar Association into finally, after several years, coming around to the defense of people who, after all, were defending their rights under the Constitution.
Steve Babson, you and I sort of blithely talk about the Communist Party and what have you, and probably to people under 50, it doesn't raise many signals. Certainly people over that remember, have some memories of when the communists were our enemies and the communists working in this country were subversives and tools of Moscow and what have you. How in your book or do you treat this? I mean, that communism now seems like certainly, well, in the way it is, yesterday's newspaper, but then it was pretty lively. How did Ernie Goodman, was he a slave of Moscow?
Well, he was accused of being so because he defended communists when they were falsely accused of being subversives and devoted to force and violence. But it's a complicated story because the Communist Party was a very mixed bag in this period. The Communist Party made many mistakes in terms of their identification with the Soviet Union and their defense of Joseph Stalin, when in fact Stalin and the Soviet Union were devoted to a very totalitarian and nasty internal politics that crushed all dissent. But in the United States, the Communist Party, at the same time, most of its members were devoted to the ideals of equality before the law and rights for workers and support for unionization and a decent wage and opposition to the sort of corporate violence that greeted many people when they tried to organize unions. And so Ernie identified with them. His closest links, really, with the members of the Communist Party were with the people at the grassroots, particularly, for example, at Local 600, the UAW Ford local in Dearborn, a local which at its peak had roughly 80,000 members working in that massive complex in Dearborn. And those were the people Ernie identified and worked with, not the national leaders who very often did fall in to sort of lockstep with Soviet policy.
Time is a-flying, and that's why the book, The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights, is 500 pages. We're just skimming the surface here and moving along the decades pretty quickly. Ernie Goodman's last case, as you said, big case, as you said, Steve Babson, was revolved around the Attica Revolt and his defense of a man named Shango. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, the Attica Rebellion in 1971 was a remarkable event in its own right. This was at the time a moment where there were more Americans killing Americans in any single event than since the Civil War. And it was a rebellion at Attica Prison in northern New York over the terrible conditions that prevailed in that prison, the abuse of the prisoner population. These, after all, were prisoners who had been, in many cases, convicted of violent crimes, and yet they still, I think, had a genuine claim to humane treatment, and their rebellion insisted on their being treated as men, Shango was one of the key leaders of that rebellion, which ended with a massacre conducted by the National Guard and the New York State Police and some of the prison guards who were armed with scattershot shotguns and blasted their way back into the prison after the prisoners had held a portion of that prison for 4 days demanding improvements in their living conditions. And 39 people were killed. 10 of them were the hostages that the prisoners had held, but they were actually shot by the police who were fighting their way into the prison. And Ernie came to the defense of Shango, who was one of the key leaders of that rebellion, and exposed the extraordinary web of coerced testimony that the prison officials and state officials had coerced out of prisoners, the false testimony and false claims that initially indicated Shango was simply a murderer. And it was Ernie's work, along with many other lawyers, I should say, many of them members of the National Lawyers Guild, many from Detroit, who helped on the case. Over several years of litigation, finally exposed the state's coercive tactics and misrepresentation of what had happened, and won acquittal for Shango.
You, at the beginning of our conversation about your book that you co-authored, The Color of Law, sort of summed up Ernie Goodman's life. I mean, looking back as we have about another minute or so, and from time to time during our discussion, you talked about that this isn't just history. It's not just, quote, interesting, although it's extraordinarily interesting. What would you hope for in terms of this book, the impact it would have on, like law students, for instance, or just the general reading population?
Well, I would hope that it would persuade people that the sometimes demoralizing circumstances of the present, in which the future looks pretty bleak when you're thinking about prospects for work and for social justice. And what Ernie's life tells us is that the only way in which we can make our way forward as a nation and as a society is when each one of us makes that commitment to principle and does what they can, puts their shoulder to the wheel, or in effect puts their shoulder to the pendulum, because as many people understand it, there is a pendulum to the politics of this country, and it moves from progressive change, sometimes to reaction. That pendulum doesn't move back and forth, however, without people actually putting their shoulder to it and giving it everything they can in the way of a commitment to social justice.
Well, Steve Babson, thank you so much for coming in. Steve Babson, along with Dave Riddle and David Elsela, has written The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights. It's an extraordinary book. It's published by the Great Lakes Book Series from Wayne State University Press. You can go to erniegoodman.com, and there's lots of events around this book coming up. You might want to check that out. And there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Steve Babson, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
If you're like most companies, you're probably asking your employees to do more than ever before. But in today's tough economy, how do you boost morale without breaking the budget? Ask Comerica. Introducing the Comerica Office Perks Program. We're helping our customers reward their employees with office-wide perks. If you have a Comerica business account, your employees can earn $100 when they open a new Comerica checking account and meet other requirements. Plus, the company earns a $50 bonus for each employee who signs up. That can really add up to a nice pool of money for a company party, the coffee fund, or simply additional bonuses. If you're not a Comerica Business Deposit customer yet, just open any new business deposit account, like Comerica Business Checking, for example. Make a $5,000 deposit, and we'll add $200 more to your office pool. For complete program rules, stop by a Comerica Banking Center or visit comerica.com/officeperks. Comerica Bank, member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Place your bids now during the Motor City Steals and Deals Fall into Savings online auction. Save more than 50% off retail prices.
That's right, more than 50% off artwork by Thomas Kincaid and Peter Max. A Yamaha ATV, hockey training, spa packages, wine tastings, tanning, and more.
What are you waiting for?
What are you waiting for?
Log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and place your bids now. That's MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. We know you love to save money. That's why we know you'll love MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Each weekday, MotorCityDailyDeal.com sends an unbelievable deal right to your inbox. We're working with local businesses to make sure these deals save you 50 to 85% off. Restaurants, salons, spas, events, and more. You get incredible deals from great local businesses like these.
Napier's Kennel Shop in Birmingham. Andiamo Novi Theater in Novi. Strawberry Moon in Ferndale, Cup Dot Cake in Royal Oak, and Deluxe Lounge in Detroit.
And these deals are so good, they're only available for 24 hours. That's right, just 24 hours, then they're gone. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's your new local way to save on all the cool things you love to eat, see, and do. Log on, sign up, and save with MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com. MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
101 WRIF.
Rock.
Yeah, you rock.
The Riff.